You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson.
It is my great privilege to welcome back to Talk Nation Radio this week Rania Kalik, who is an independent Middle East-based journalist. Rania, welcome back to Talk Nation Radio.
Thanks, David. It's so great to be on with you again.
Great to have you on the show. Great to have you back in this country. You've been in the Middle East for quite a while. Where have you been, and when did you get back?
For about a year, I've been based in the Middle East and a little bit in Europe, but basically Beirut, Syria, and Iraq. And I've done some reporting from there. And I just got back to the U.S. a couple weeks ago, just visiting some family. And I haven't been back in about a year. And I got to say, the political climate here is intense in a way like that doesn't really come off when you're outside of the country. In terms of just the anti-Russia hysteria. Also, when I came here, I landed, I was actually in the air as the alleged chemical weapons attacks took place in Syria. And so when I got here, it was just constant warmongering everywhere I turned in D.C. So it's been quite an experience being back.
Yeah, that's interesting. We may be in that, you know, pot that they're heating so slowly we don't notice. But if you're gone for a year, you notice it. Really, you don't see the Russophobia and the Russiagate and the warmongering in Washington when you're abroad. You have to be here to see that.
It's not that you have to be here. I mean, I see it. I see it in reading the news. I see it in watching, CNN International. But even that's not as bad as what you get domestically in this country. And also, it's also just the political climate in D.C., the atmosphere. It's just not the same abroad. Even in Europe, I spent a little bit of time in Europe. And, you know, obviously there's some anti-Russia sentiment there. But it's just nothing really parallels what you see in the U.S. right now, the hysteria. In the U.S. is just so extreme and so suffocating that it's not, I mean, I would say even in the U.K. it's not the same. And also, certainly not in the Middle East at all. So it's just really surprising being back here and just seeing how crazy it's gotten. I mean, people that I'm friends with who are otherwise pretty smart people also play into this stuff and believe it. And so it's really intense. And then also, when I got back, like I said, the chemical weapons attack that was alleged to take place in Syria happened. And so I was just, you know, everywhere you go in D.C., CNN is on in, like, every restaurant, even, like, a hotel elevator. It was being aired. And so it was just everywhere I looked, it was constant calling for bombing Syria and calling for, like, retaliation to, you know, an escalation against Russia. And I was just really shocked by how deluged people are with these sentiments.
So what do people in the United States think and believe about Syria that's different from how people in Syria and other parts of the world see things?
Well, in the U.S., I mean, there's just no... You only get one view, and that's it. Like, you just get the view of the sort of U.S. State Department-approved view of Syria that is just very black and white. Syrian government is evil and massacring civilians across Syria and, like, eating babies for fun. And that's the only view you get. In the Middle East, of course, it's far more nuanced. I mean, some people in the Middle East do think that, but also there are people on the other side of that debate, and then also people who understand what's happening, which is that the U.S. spent the last several years in collaboration with its allies in the region, arming and funding a collection of Salafi jihadist groups across Syria that prolong the civil war that's taken place in that country. And in fact, you know, one thing that's really apparent to me when I come here is just how distorted the image of a country like Syria is. Also, this goes for Iraq as well, as it's portrayed in the U.S. press as though it's like this apocalyptic hellscape, when in fact the war is kind of winding down. And in a lot of areas of Syria, it's returned to, you know, stability, and people are kind of going back to their normal lives because the war is coming to an end. largely because the U.S. and its allies stopped funding and arming the groups I mentioned before. And so, yeah, it's just, I mean, you come here and it's just, it doesn't, like, the image you get of Syria doesn't make any sense. It's actually the more distorted and convoluted than the coverage of Israel-Palestine.
But that sounds like good news, even if it's good news we don't hear much about, the U.S. Stopping funding a bunch of war makers, a bunch of terrorists in Syria pushing toward the overthrow of another government, abandoning that disastrous, immoral, illegal, counterproductive approach to Syria sounds like a very good thing.
It absolutely is, but it's, in this country, in the U.S., the media kind of had a meltdown when Donald Trump announced that the U.S. would end its covert weapons program, which actually already started to end under Obama before he left office. But the U.S. media also had a meltdown when Donald Trump suggested that the U.S. pull out of Syria. So the coverage you get here makes no sense. It's very convoluted and very distorted, and it's a good thing. In Syria, the best thing that's happening right now is the de-escalation of violence is taking place, and reconciliation agreements in areas across the country that were formerly under insurgent control, areas that I've actually visited. It's allowed people, people in this country don't understand what war is. They don't understand what it means and how it really destroys people's lives. They don't understand what it means to collapse a state. Even though we did it in Iraq and we saw the results of that were disastrous, in Syria, the U.S. did collapse the state in large parts of that country. And in the areas that were collapsed, these insurgent groups, these, like you mentioned, criminal gangs really took over, and it was absolute chaos, and it was a horror show. And so people are happy that it's moving towards less violence. That should actually be the end goal, to be less violence, de-escalating violence, and allowing Syria to recover from this trauma that we've inflicted on that country for all these years.
And yet Donald Trump pretty quickly reversed, at least in his rhetoric, and bowed before the power of the media or the Pentagon or somebody and said, no, we're not going to get out of Syria with U.S. troops until we leave a strong and lasting footprint or something, which God knows what that is. If nothing done thus far has been strong or lasting, I shudder to think what would be. But it seems that he's pretty easily reversed.
Well, because, none of his ideas are really based in substance. At the end of the day, I don't think Donald Trump really cares one way or another what takes place. He's also being influenced by a war cabinet that he's built around him that obviously, wants to stay in Syria indefinitely. That would have happened if Obama was still in power. That's U.S. policy in the region. I don't think you're going to see the U.S. pulling out of Syria, no matter what Donald Trump says, because at the end of the day, the foreign policy establishment, the Pentagon, the war makers, if you will, want leverage and control in Syria and leverage in the region. But the fact of the matter is that in Syria, the U.S. lost. And they're having a really difficult time, I think, dealing with that. The U.S. lost in Syria. That doesn't necessarily mean Syria won, but the U.S. designed for Syria, which was regime overthrow, didn't work. They lost because Syria, unlike Libya, unlike Iraq, had allies that stuck by it, including Iran and, most importantly, Russia. That's probably Russia's involvement in Syria is probably the biggest deterrent to the U.S. getting its way in that country. I think a lot of the confusing rhetoric and, lack of really coherent policy ideas around Syria have a lot to do with the fact that the U.S. isn't used to being in this position of losing.
It's funny that you put it that way, because despite the fact that the United States successfully overthrew governments in places like Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya and elsewhere, I never thought of them as victories or successes, given what catastrophic, drawn-out disasters they produced. We haven't seen a victory parade in Washington, D.C. since the Gulf War. I know Trump is going to hold one in November anyway, but I guess Syria is somehow a different level of loss in the...
Yeah, that's a good way to put it.
I should think after decades without, anything they really called a success or a victory, they ought to be getting used to it.
Well, you know, actually, David, I think that U.S. designs in countries like Afghanistan and Iraq and Libya, I think the goal is chaos and destabilization. Like, I think in a sense that is a victory because it's basically it basically makes it impossible for these countries to function independently ever. And also it makes them countries that are in perpetual war. I mean, it keeps the pockets of weapons makers, full of money indefinitely. Yeah. So in a way, chaos and destabilization, even though Iraq didn't turn out the way like neocons said it would, where it was going to be some flourishing democracy, in a way, creating the chaos and destabilization in Iraq was successful in some way for the U.S., although, of course, it had other consequences that, you know, kind of erupted in America's face. But either way, I mean, I think destabilization and chaos is the goal.
Yeah, and that goal in Syria, that sort of permanent war without any resolution in Syria, seems aided by the incredible divisiveness of the topic. I mean, I've never seen anything divide the so-called peace movement or the general public in this way, so that someone like myself who just opposes war, the minute I say one word against the government of Syria or the government of Russia, I'm a U.S. imperialist who loves Donald Trump or Barack Obama. and the minute I say one word against U.S. military actions in Syria, well, now I'm an Assad-loving defender of the angelic government of Syria and Vladimir Putin. Like, you can't say one word against one side because it's all or nothing. It's why?
Well, I think this is deliberate. I mean, these are deliberate efforts to fracture the anti-war left, which is, I think, weaker than it's been in my lifetime. And maybe that's an extreme thing to say, but it does. I don't see it anywhere. I mean, I see very small groups of people who vocally oppose war, but at the same time, Syria has been an incredibly divisive issue. I think a part of that is because people don't really know what the U.S. did in Syria. I mean, yes, the Syrian government is bad in many ways, very, very flawed. And a lot of things about the Syrian government absolutely need to change. There's no question about that. But at the same time, you know, people aren't really aware, and that I blame the media for that to a large degree, aren't aware that the U.S. played a major role in destabilizing that country and prolonging this war. And if they knew that, I think they'd be, like, if they knew that the U.S. funded death squads in Syria, which is basically what happened all these years, I think that you'd have more momentum against that. But instead, what you have is a media apparatus that portrays Syria as some conflict that's been so terrible, where, again, like I said earlier, the government, you know, it's just the government bad, the rebellion is great and good, and that the U.S. just kind of stood on the sidelines and did nothing all this time. And stayed neutral and, like, should have done something. But that's, like, I mean, that couldn't be further from the truth. The U.S. spent at least $1 billion a year funding and arming this insurgency in Syria with its regional allies. I mean, it's the best-funded insurgency in history. And people don't know that. Moreover, I think one of the most scandalous aspects of what the U.S. did in Syria was that it armed and funded groups that worked alongside Al-Qaeda and ISIS. Openly worked alongside Al-Qaeda and ISIS under the banner of the FSA. I mean, this is a huge scandal. The group that claims responsibility for 9/11 has grown to have its largest affiliate in northern Syria ever, tens of thousands of people. I'm talking about Al-Qaeda, because of U.S. policy arming and funding them in Syria. I mean, it's so outrageous. But people don't know that. And instead, you have all this moral posturing and virtue signaling, you know, about, you know, if you're against intervention in Syria, you know, Western imperialism in Syria, you're, you know, the first thing you get called is an Assadist, as though you just, like, have posters of him hanging in your bedroom.
Right. What do you make, and what do people in Syria and in the region make of so much attention to accusations of chemical weapons use after years of numerous parties, including Al-Qaeda and related groups, killing all kinds of people with all kinds of weaponry? Is there the same focus on the chemical weapons accusation in Syria that there is in Washington?
No. No, because not just in Syria, but I would say more generally in the Middle East. I mean, look, there's been plenty of wars in the Middle East, and people have died more so by conventional weapons. So this weird focus, like this weird obsessive, unique focus on chemical weapons doesn't really make sense to people. Because all kinds of weapons have been used, specifically in the war in Syria. And, you know, chemical weapons don't even, I'm not saying they're great, but they don't, compared to conventional weapons, they don't kill as many people, they don't actually do as much damage. So it's a confusing idea to a lot of people. It's like, why is there this weird focus on this one weapon when, like, it's like there's all these other weapons being used? Beyond that, I mean, in government areas of Syria, where the vast majority of people live, people don't believe there's been chemical weapons attacks. They think it's like a big U.S. For the most part, people think it's a big, you know, Western conspiracy to try and overthrow the government. And even, I mean, again, like even people who are living in government areas who maybe oppose the government, many of those kinds of people exist, are also very skeptical of Western narratives about Syria, and they largely blame the West for the conflict in their country. On top of that, I mean, the timing is just remarkable. It's whenever the Syrian government is on the verge of defeating insurgents in whatever area of Syria, you oftentimes get these accusations of chemical weapons attacks or all kinds of attacks to try and provoke Western intervention, because that's all that can save the insurgents, is they need outside intervention to save them. And so the Syrian government doesn't benefit from using chemical weapons. I mean, the Syrian government's a lot of things, but they're not stupid. And it would make no sense to cross this, like, red line that they've been told repeatedly by Western governments exists for no tactical benefit whatsoever when they're about to defeat insurgents. So, yeah, people are really skeptical of this narrative. A lot of people are. But in the U.S., to just question the State Department narrative gets you branded like some sort of conspiracy theorist wearing a tinfoil hat, which I find really disturbing, that you're not allowed to question or be critical of anything, apparently.
We're speaking with Rania Kalik, who is an independent journalist based in the Middle East. Rania, I thought the way that you determined the facts of such questions was to see what color helmets people are wearing. Because if they're wearing white helmets, then it's true, right? What's your analysis of the white helmets?
I mean, the white helmets are are a PR front group. I mean, there's no question about this. They have been funded to the tunes of tens of millions of dollars by Western governments, including the U.S. State Department, as well as the U.K. Foreign Office, to push for a no-fly zone in Syria. That is their reason for existing, and they're oftentimes embedded with the insurgent groups that control the areas they operate in, which are exclusively insurgent held, which oftentimes are al-Qaeda or its clones. It's so obvious. But again, to question this at all or to say this, again, gets you branded as though you're some, like, lunatic, which I find really stunning. And, the footage that's put out by the White Helmet has a huge impact for a reason, because it's being pushed by this massive PR group called the Syria Campaign. And it has such influence that anytime the White Helmet puts out video, it ends up being re-aired on every major media outlet in America, and oftentimes it has swayed Donald Trump to bomb Syria. So we have to be critical, and, like, we have to look at these things with a critical eye. I don't think there should be anything controversial. That's a fact that I just stated, is that the White Helmet is funded to the tunes of tens of millions of dollars by the U.S. and U.K. Foreign Office for the purposes of pushing for intervention, Western intervention in Syria. That's a fact.
Yeah. They seem to be doing a much better job at the moment than Israeli propaganda, if we can turn to the subject of Palestine. I mean, I don't know that it makes any difference in U.S. policy, as the U.S. keeps giving billions of dollars of free weapons to the Israeli military every year. But we're seeing sharpshooters murdering men, women, and children engaged in nonviolent protests. What's going on in Gaza?
Well, what's happening in Gaza is you have the Israeli army behaving basically like with no restraint whatsoever. It's almost as though they're kind of testing the waters to see what they can get away with. And I think under the Trump administration, what they've realized is they can get away with just about anything. So they're shooting. I mean, they're picking off and mowing down protesters from sniper rifles in the Gaza Strip. And they're doing it on video. And I mean, what's stunning is how you don't hear the same, you know, howl for the West to do something about Palestine when we're watching it happen before our eyes. And it's because a government that's friendly with the U.S. is the one that's doing it. And it really does. I mean, it just really demonstrates the complete hypocrisy of American policy in the region, where, you know, one government is a dictatorship that must be overthrown because of its violence, whereas another government is our friend and its violence is totally excused and even justified in the case of Palestine.
And it seems like over the decades when Palestinians have engaged in relatively small levels of violence, they've been universally condemned, and perhaps rightly so. But here you have them committing to massive nonviolence and putting their lives at risk nonviolently, opposing violence, and you have sharpshooters murdering them. And I don't see the same level of uproar in their defense when they're doing what everyone presumably thought they ought to be doing.
I mean, you actually have had Thomas Friedman write a column before basically saying that Palestinians should just go get shot by the Israeli army on video protesting nonviolently, and it'll just change everything in the West. Well, they're doing that now.
Yeah.
They've done it before, but they're doing that again now, and it's changed absolutely nothing. And I don't know where, like, Thomas Friedman hasn't, as far as I can tell, written a column about the Palestinian nonviolent protests in Gaza. So, it is really stunning to watch. And what's also really stunning is the same people, and a lot of the same people who are basically, even when Palestinians demonstrate nonviolently, they're still branded as rioters who are somehow deserving of a violent response. For provoking the Israelis by just existing, I guess. But the same people who have that view of Palestinians, where they're constantly calling for Palestinians to be nonviolent, are oftentimes very, very supportive of the Al-Qaeda-allied groups in Syria, just like shelling Damascus relentlessly with Saudi and Qatari and U.S.-supplied arms. It just kind of demonstrates some more of like this hypocrisy. It's like nothing I've ever seen.
Well, I take seriously the arguments that nonviolent movements are more likely to succeed and that they are not guaranteed to succeed and that they are very difficult. So I sort of do encourage the Palestinians in what they're doing, but is it beginning to make any progress, you know, outside of the U.S. media, which ought to be, you know, probably the last place that they win ground? Are these weekly protests having any impact in the Middle East?
You know, what's really sad, and maybe I'm going to sound a little cynical when I say this, is that the conflicts that have raged across the Middle East for the last 20 or so years, beginning with the invasion of Iraq, have really fragmented the Middle East. I mean, people still are supportive of the idea of, you know, Palestine versus Israel, but it doesn't resonate as much anymore across the region, I don't think. And a lot of that has to do with the sectarianism that's been fueled by U.S. policy in the region, where people see themselves, you know, as Sunnis or Shias or Christians first before anything else. So that's a part of it. But also there's just other conflicts happening in the region, especially with Syria, that has kind of distracted from what's taking place in Palestine. So while people do still have some semblance of solidarity with Palestine, it's not really high up on the agenda, and that's unfortunate. That's probably the biggest victory for U.S. and Israeli and Saudi policy in the region the last couple of decades, is to be able to fracture the base of support for the liberation of Palestine in the region. As for Palestine, I mean, I think that in terms of, like, Europe and the U.S., I think public opinion is certainly changing. Especially among, in the U.S., among liberals, among Democrats specifically, you have far more support for Palestinians than in the past, and a decreasing level of support for Israel. And that's because, again, like you mentioned earlier, Israeli PR isn't as good as it used to be. And also, Israel's becoming more and more right-wing. It's moving more and more towards the far right. The government is. And it's becoming a place that it's more and more difficult for, like, American liberals to sympathize with this right-wing, this, like, really gross, kind of vile right-wing rhetoric you hear from Israeli officials. And so I think that the public opinion is certainly changing. I don't know that government policy is going to change anytime soon, but I don't think Israel can last in the way it exists right now. I mean, something is definitely going to change at some point. It's like it's just going to happen with time.
We've just got a few minutes left. It's a lot of negative and a lot and some positive trends there. What should we be encouraging? BDS efforts have any value? What would people in the Middle East say to people in the United States and in Washington, D.C.? What would they want us to be trying to work on in restraining our government and improving that region of the world if we can?
I can't speak for everybody, but I think most importantly, the U.S. needs to get out of the Middle East. U.S. involvement in the Middle East, Western involvement in the Middle East has been a catastrophe for the region, and it continues to be. And the U.S. needs to get out. And that should be, at the very least, something that people in the peace movement and the anti-war left in the U.S. should be able to agree on. Whether, you know, you think the governments in the region are terrible or whether you like them doesn't really matter. What's most important is that the U.S. needs to get out of the region. That's what's going to help the Middle East. And, you know, BDS is, of course, a big part of that. And that what comes with that is the U.S. side, not just divesting from Israel, but the U.S. needs to end its, you know, billions of dollars of military support for the Israeli government. Same goes for the U.S. support for Saudi Arabia and the Gulf monarchies in the region. This is one of the biggest problems holding the region back, is U.S. involvement and support for reactionary governments in the region, and that needs to end.
You would think the left could agree on that, but every time I turn on Democracy Now!, some new guest is telling me that the United States needs to overthrow the Assad government. That's the left.
And this is on the War and Peace Report, of all things. I mean, look, I'm somebody who my politics were shaped by Democracy Now! In many ways. I was introduced to a lot of left thinkers and intellectuals and journalists watching. I think I saw you, David.
It's been a while.
My politics starts. It's been a while, yeah. But I mean, you're somebody who I probably learned about who you were watching Democracy Now! At one point. So it had a big influence on me, sort of when I was younger and you know, choosing to become a journalist. But now, so it's been really, really difficult for me to watch the sort of fall of the War and Peace Report, where it just seems like a parade of war hawks, oftentimes Syrian exiles, calling for the destruction of their own country from afar, and no other voices. They really dominate the voices that you hear on Democracy Now! When it comes to Syria. And the same can be said for some other issues as well, unfortunately. So, I mean, I guess the best thing I can say is, I mean, I think I just made a really good case for something we can all agree on. And, you know, if you're in support of Western intervention and if you're in support of the U.S. and if you're imperialism in the Middle East for whatever reason, then I don't think you can really call yourself somebody who's in the peace movement or somebody who's on the left, because that is really the antithesis of everything it means to be anti-imperialist and on the left, regardless, again, of what you think of the local politics of the region. That doesn't mean you have to love the Syrian government, no more than it meant that you had to love the Saddam Hussein government in Iraq to oppose U.S. invading that country.
Very good point to end on. We're out of time, I'm afraid. Rania Kalik is an independent journalist based in the Middle East, headed back to the Middle East now. Thank you very much, Rania, for taking the time to come on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you so much, David.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, in January of 2017, the country was still reeling, as indeed we continue to reel, from the election of Donald Trump. Corporate news media were full of allegations of Russian hacking of the election, and at one point we were told the electrical grid in Vermont. Barack Obama signed off on something called the Countering Disinformation and Propaganda Act, the point of which was to aim communications at people overseas to countermessage the ideas of terrorists, as defined, of course, by the state. And a website launched purporting to serve as a watch list on professors deemed guilty of advancing leftist propaganda in the classroom. The feeling in the air led Counterspin to speak with Ellen Schrecker, retired professor of American history at Yeshiva University and author of a number of books, including Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, and No Ivory Tower, McCarthyism in the Universities. It's just over a year later, and corporate news media are, well, full of allegations of Russian hacking. The Democratic National Committee is suing the Russian government over emails, along the way declaring that WikiLeaks, and by extension any outlet that publishes misappropriated documents, like the Pentagon Papers or Donald Trump's tax returns, should be prosecuted for economic espionage. The New York Times warned readers recently that Russia has amped up its arsenal in cyber and nuclear threats, but the U.S. has done little in response. The U.S., where the military budget was just increased by $80 billion, an increase that dwarfs the entire Russian military budget of $47 billion. Never mind, says the paper of record, Russia might at any moment strike our, quote, banks, utilities, stock markets, and communications networks, close quote. Today, we're going to revisit our conversation with historian Ellen Schrecker and its reminder that while not everything old is new again, we have been down this road before. Ellen Schrecker and the New McCarthyism, this week on Counterspin. When Atlanta NPR affiliate WABE profiled African-American activist Anoa Tchanga last month, it wasn't to talk about her work. It was to present her as a pawn of the Kremlin because she has appeared on Sputnik, a TV channel funded by the Russian government. By agreeing to appear on two Sputnik programs, reporter Johnny Kaufman said, quote, Tchanga gained something hard to find, a bigger platform to broadcast her political views. But Tchanga's association with Sputnik may put her credibility at risk while furthering Russia's effort to create chaos in the U.S., close quote. Which, as Fair's Adam Johnson noted, sounded a bit more like a threat than an observation. Nice reputation you've got there. Shame if anything were to happen to it. We never hear how Tchanga's progressive activism promotes chaos, but a professor is quoted saying, quote, those platforms are set up for the sole purpose of promoting the Kremlin line. The idea is to create as much chaos as possible because the Russians see it as a zero-sum game where anything that weakens us is going to strengthen them, close quote. Who's us exactly and who's them? The story doesn't say, nor does it tell listeners that the professor works for the National Endowment for Democracy, a U.S. government-funded project set up for the sole purpose of promoting the White House line in the Cold War. Or that Tchanga has also appeared on the BBC, that British government-funded network. That would muddy the narrative. Because it's not a discussion of which government funding is corrupting and which isn't, or what makes it so. It's, as Johnson writes, just a U.S. media outlet singling out official enemies and using them as a bludgeon to marginalize the already marginalized and sully those with an unapologetic critique of U.S. society and empire. It's also, unfortunately, predictable fallout from Democrats and many media's ongoing Russia fixation, which, as Norman Solomon wrote recently, quote, leaves significantly less messaging space for economic and social issues that the vast majority of Americans care about far more, close quote. There are, of course, numerous reasons to lament the 2016 election, to do all we can to understand it and resist its impact. In doing that, we can learn from history about how much is lost when fear is allowed to dominate political possibilities. Counterspin talked about this around the time of Trump's inauguration with Ellen Schrecker, now retired professor of American history at Yeshiva University and author of, among other titles, Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, and No Ivory Tower, McCarthyism in the Universities. Here now is that interview from January 2017, starting with a quite long introduction from me. We have major media afroth with tales of Russian hacking of the presidential election, giving millions of Americans the idea that Russian agents actually tampered with voting machines. A Democratic president just signed off on something called the Countering Disinformation and Propaganda Act, tasked to aim communications at foreign audiences to counter-message the ideas of state-defined terrorists and other extremists in the information space. That was part of the National Defense Authorization Act, a previous iteration of which eliminated parts of the Smith-Mundt Act that prevented the U.S. government from propagandizing domestic audiences. And while legislation making its way through Congress sets up an interagency committee empowered to target Russian media manipulation, along with such other duties as the president, that would be Trump, may designate, a new website purports to serve as a watch list on professors deemed guilty of advancing leftist propaganda in the classroom. The Washington Post trumpets a completely unfounded story about Russians hacking the electrical grid in Vermont a few weeks after promoting a report by an anonymous group on websites accused of purveying fake news in service of a Russian campaign to undermine American interests. And the Wall Street Journal declares it wouldn't be objective to use the word lie when referring to Donald Trump's false statements. It is quite a moment. And while not everything old is new again, it's better not to pretend this is this country's first excursion into enemies' lists and official encouragement to ferret out the insufficiently patriotic. The first inclination is to evoke the McCarthy era. In what ways does and doesn't the present moment echo that time, and what are the threads that connect that not-so-long-ago period to today? We're joined now by Ellen Schrecker, now retired professor of American history at Yeshiva University and author of, among other titles, Many Are the Crimes, McCarthyism in America, and No Ivory Tower, McCarthyism in the Universities. She joins us by phone. Welcome to Counterspin, Ellen Schrecker.
Thank you very much, and it's a pleasure to be talking with you.
Well, I know that that introduction was sort of overwhelming. I meant it to be. I think folks are feeling overwhelmed. It's almost a key feature of the present moment. And that feeling, who do you trust? Is the enemy of my enemy my friend? That feeling can be instrumentalized, if you will. Confusion and fear lead people to accept things and do things that they might not do otherwise. When we think about McCarthyism, we tend, naturally enough, to think about Joe McCarthy. But I wonder, do you think in a way that the lessons, such as they are, might lie less in him than in what that time brought out in other people?
Very much so. McCarthy was a convenient figurehead. He was an aberrant personality. He was a guy who knew how to play the press brilliantly, But actually, he came rather late to the movement that he gave his name to. He didn't really surface until 1950, by which point there had been years of hearings by the House Un-American Activities Committee. The federal government had imposed a very ideological loyalty security program on its employees. McCarthyism, in other words, was going full steam even before McCarthy showed up at the station. And I think the main thing that we have to be careful about is not to confuse McCarthy with McCarthyism, because McCarthyism was a much broader movement. And similarly, not to sort of think that Trump is everything that is happening today. Because I think what is happening today is the fruit of 40 years of a concerted right-wing conservative effort to delegitimize a lot of what we would consider liberal moderate orthodoxy, to delegitimize things like climate change, for example, which, you know, is pretty scary. McCarthyism was the same way. What we saw in the 1950s was a very broad-based movement designed ostensibly to eliminate all the influence of American communism and all the people involved with it and the ideas and the organizations connected to it, to eliminate that from American life. Now, there were communists. I mean, one of the myths of the McCarthy period was that McCarthy and the HUAC and all the other sort of second-tier witch hunters were targeting innocent people. Well, they were and they weren't. These people were certainly innocent of crimes. They hadn't done anything wrong. But politically, these were people on the left. These were people, many of them, probably the vast majority of them, the people who were called up by committees or blacklisted, had had some connection to the American Communist Party and who were still willing to defy the status quo, the sort of standard Cold War consensus, enough to refuse to name names, to refuse to collaborate with this witch hunting machine. And it was a machine. And so what we saw was a drive against the left, and one that was incredibly successful. I mean, that's the thing that we can't just sort of say, look at the 1950s and say, oh, McCarthy, you know, he was censored by the Senate. Everything turned out fine. Well, everything didn't turn out fine. We ended up with a war in Vietnam, among other things. But also, what had happened was that the American political spectrum narrowed, that a whole bunch of ideas and causes kind of disappeared from American political discourse and American political life. And I can give you examples from the labor movement that stopped trying to organize white-collar workers, for example, or from the civil rights movement, which in the late 1940s had a very strong kind of economic justice component. And that was completely wiped out, largely because many of the people who were pushing this broader notion of what civil rights was did have some communist connections, were concerned about issues of economic class, and were simply booted out of the civil rights movement, the mainstream civil rights movement, which was trying to protect itself against some very ferocious red baiting. So what we see as a result of McCarthyism is a much narrower range of political ideas that impoverish the American political scene and put a stop to creating a much stronger safety net, for example. Mm-hmm. We're seeing it now with an attempt of the Republicans to roll back Obamacare. Well, back in the late 1940s, President Truman wanted to get the equivalent of Medicare for all. You know, he wanted a full federal financing of health care, the same as that exists throughout much of the industrialized world. But he was attacked. It was considered, quote unquote, socialized medicine, and it has yet to return to American politics.
Yes, you hear folks now saying we'll survive this, you know, like we survived McCarthyism. I mean, we post-date it, you know, but there were, I think we forget that there were costs, you know, that actual people and actual, as you point out, causes were hurt. There was fallout there, and it's not simply enough to say, well, we're going to get through it as though there's no damage.
Right. I think that's very true. And what I would like to emphasize is one of the reasons there was so much damage and one of the reasons why so many people lost their jobs and even more people just shut up. I'll give you one example of this is I taught late 20th century American history. U.S. since 1945 was my main course. And I would talk about McCarthyism, and then I would ask my students to talk about the anti-war movement against the Korean War, which began in 1950 and was every bit as unpopular, according to the polls, as the Vietnam War was, but we don't know that very well. And I would be greeted by silence in my classes, and I'd say, yeah, that's the right answer. In other words, McCarthyism had thoroughly prevented any attempt to criticize the Korean War. In my writing, I always sort of say, well, wait a minute, what about the books that weren't written, the movies that weren't made, the unions that weren't organized? In other words, the damage from McCarthyism is not just people losing their jobs or going to jail, but all of the movements, all of the projects, all of the books and ideas that weren't out there in American life. And that's the kind of thing that's very scary, because we'll never know.
Right.
What I think is responsible for a lot of that and a lot of the self-censorship, which was really ferocious during that period, was the collaboration of what we could see as the moderate middle, the willingness not just of politicians or journalists, but university presidents and hospital administrators, all kinds of people, to go along with McCarthyism, to somehow buy into the notion that the Constitution protected everybody but communists. And so what we got in the 1950s was institution after institution within civil society, all the way up to and including the Supreme Court, refusing to defend the rights of individuals who were attacked during this period and operating on the assumption that somehow if you were named by HUAC and took the Fifth Amendment, there was something wrong with you. And people knew better. That was what gave McCarthyism so much power, was this collaboration of the employers, of the mainstream media, of the legal system, you name it, to go along with this anti-communist purge.
Well, I remember hearing a talk long ago by Robert Kuttner in which he talked about the abandonment of professional ethics. And this is in the 90s, I guess, or early 2000s. Yeah. He was talking about, you know, lawyers saying, okay, I can squint and make the law say that torture is okay. You know, doctors saying, okay, I can make force-feeding prisoners at Guantanamo square with my Hippocratic Oath. You know, there's no competing ethics with that is set out by political power, you know, and that does more than undermine resistance. I mean, there's no kind of alternate set of values in evidence for people.
Exactly, exactly. Although, to their credit, one has to say, the liberals did wake up.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it took a while. It took really until the mid to late 50s for the Supreme Court to begin to rule that some of the practices of the Red Baiters were wrong for the civil rights movement to pick up again, although in a somewhat attenuated way.
Right.
There was no longer this stress on economic justice, but rather on sort of legal rights and civil rights, important as they were. It wasn't the whole story of racial inequality in America by any means.
Right.
I think the important thing is to avoid going along with this, these watch lists. And there is hope.
Let me ask you about that hope, because the word watch list itself, I think, for many people sends a shiver. But at least with regard to universities in particular, we are seeing pushback. So let me just draw you out on that. Where are you seeing resistance?
Okay. Well, I am seeing resistance in a number of places. With regard to some of these threats, shall we say, to civil liberties and civil rights, one of the most alarming ones is this notion of a registry of American Muslims. And what we're hearing from a number of groups and individuals is what I call the King of Denmark moment, which comes from the experience during World War II when the Third Reich, Hitler, invaded Denmark and forced all the Danish Jews to wear yellow stars, and the King of Denmark put on a yellow star as well, obviously showing a great deal of courage there. And we are hearing a number of groups and individuals saying, well, if it comes to that in this country, I'm going to register as a Muslim too. We've actually seen that happen within the academic community with this professor's blacklist that was published, of started out some 200 names. It's a weird little list because it doesn't by any means list all the more serious leftists and political activists within the academic community. It seems to be a kind of hodgepodge. I think many of them probably right-wing students who just sent in the names of professors who gave them C's. But anyhow, that list was published, and I began getting some interesting things in my inbox, including a letter that was sent from about 100 faculty members at Notre Dame, which is very interesting. It's a Catholic school. You know, you would expect the faculty there to be rather conservative. But here come the Fighting Irish. And they sent a letter or an email to the blacklisting organization saying, put us on the list. And then I know that professors at the University of Michigan began to do the same thing. And then an organization called the American Association of University Professors that I had been active with, that is the main sort of guardian of academic freedom, the main institutional guardian of academic freedom in this country, sent a letter to its members telling us all where to send our names in as well. So there is pushback. And more pushback than there had been during the McCarthy period. For example, during the McCarthy period, the American Association of University Professors, AAUP, simply didn't do a thing. About 100 faculty members were fired, and the AAUP, which had been theoretically supposed to look into these cases, didn't lift a finger. And we saw that throughout American society. The ACLU, for example, during the McCarthy period, would not defend anybody who had been a member of the Communist Party unless they had recanted seriously. I don't think you'd see that today. I do think that some of these organizations are much wiser and more willing to fight back. But, and let me emphasize this point, there are ways in which it's much worse. And that's because of the way in which institutions like the universities, and I'm particularly concerned about the universities, have been completely hollowed out over the past 40 years. There have been structural changes, many of them motivated by politically conservative movements to crack down on universities, and it's done through defunding, through state legislatures no longer as willing to support higher education as they had been in the 1950s.
Right. Any final thoughts?
Well, I think the main thing is really to remember above all that what we're seeing is the result of a 40-year assault on the sort of liberal mainstream. It's not an assault on the left like McCarthyism, but rather on the American mind, if I can put it that way. And so what we're seeing is people in power now, probably sponsored in one way or another by corporate interests. Certainly, we know that climate denial has very strong ties to the oil and gas industry. And it's this kind of corporate ideological assault on reality, as it were, that is so dangerous and that, you know, is not just Trump.
We've been speaking with Ellen Schrecker. Her most recent book is The Lost Soul of Higher Education, Corporatization, the Assault on Academic Freedom, and the End of the American University. Ellen Schrecker, thank you very much for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Well, thank you. It was a pleasure.
That was historian Ellen Schrecker speaking with Counterspin in January of 2017. And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them along with transcripts on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio Eco Shop with Alex Smith.
Another big wheel of the climate shift has turned. Young scientist Levka Caesar reports the Atlantic overturning current, including the Gulf Stream, has definitely weakened because of climate change. It will add to global warming and affect hundreds of millions of people on both sides of the Atlantic and around the world. Likewise, the drying of southern Europe has begun. Spain could be a desert within a lifetime. Also from Germany, expert Luis Samaniego forecasts European drought from fossil fuel burning. This is science at its best and at its most frightening. And this is Radio EcoShock. The wild change in ocean currents portrayed in the disaster movie The Day After Tomorrow has now been confirmed by science. No, not the sudden freezing disaster shown by Hollywood. But if you are concerned with weather in the eastern United States, Canada, the UK, and Europe, or if you are worried about global climate change itself, this is for you. Multiple layers of science demonstrate the great ocean current, popularly known as the Gulf Stream, has weakened significantly since 1950. Two papers on the overturning of the Atlantic waters were published in the April edition of the prestigious journal Nature. One is led by the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, or PIC. The well-known scientist Stefan Rahmstorf was deeply involved, but here the lead author is PhD candidate Livka Caesar. This is her first paper, and published in the top journal Nature, no less. From Potsdam, Germany, Livka Caesar, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Yes, thank you.
Before we get to the many impacts of big change in the Atlantic, we do need to understand what it is. When you talk to the public, Livka, how do you explain the long technical term Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC?
Well, I like to emphasize that what we call AMOC is not just a single current. So it's not just the Gulf Stream, but it's actually a major current system in the Atlantic Ocean. And the Gulf Stream is just a part of it. And this current system is actually mainly characterized by a warm flow of waters in the upper layers of the Atlantic, going from the tropics to the higher latitudes. And there, the water cools, it releases heat to the atmosphere, and as it cools, it becomes denser, because cold water is denser than warm water. It sinks to deeper layers in the ocean, and then we have a southward return flow at those deeper layers. And due to this warm flow of waters in the upper layers, and then a flow of colder waters in the deep layers of the Atlantic, we actually have a net heat transport from the tropics to the high latitudes that is carried or done by this overturning circulation.
And we will talk about the regional impacts that interest so many millions of people on both sides of the Atlantic. But first, what about the global climate change that affects everyone? Now, while researching your paper, I came across a 2014 study led by the University of Oxford scientist Yavor Kostov. And it begins, quote, "We propose here that the Atlantic Meridional Overturning Circulation, or AMOC, plays an important role in setting the effective heat capacity of the world ocean and thus impacts the pace of transient climate change." Livka, do you agree if the Atlantic overturning slows down, could that hasten the arrival of climate impacts because less heat is dropping down to the deep ocean?
Well, this is a complex question, and we have to look here at two opposing effects, perhaps acting on different timescales. So what this study showed is that, well, the AMOC helps to transport heat downwards into the ocean, as we have this overturning circulation with waters moving to or sinking to deeper ocean layers. But another effect is that when we have a slower overturning circulation in the Atlantic, we have less heat that is released to the atmosphere at high northern latitudes from the ocean. So I think there has to be more research done to study this effect. But one thing that is probably going to happen is that the ocean region in the North Atlantic is a major sink of carbon dioxide. So it's a region where the ocean takes up a lot of carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and then stores it in the deeper waters of the ocean, which is because we have colder surface waters there, and carbon dioxide is actually more easily solved in cold waters than it is in warm waters. And then, due to the overturning circulation, we have waters moving from the surface to the deeper ocean, and we have a sink, a transport of carbon dioxide from surface waters to the deep ocean. And when this overturning circulation slows down, we will likely have a positive feedback on the CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere. That is, the ocean will take up less carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, and thus the CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere could rise more quickly. So we expect feedbacks on climate as the overturning circulation is changing, but we have to study them in more detail.
Okay, let's go back to the beginning. In North America, the public knows this current as the Gulf Stream, and it's only part of it, as you say. But where does that Gulf Stream begin, and where does it get its heat?
Well, the Gulf Stream is kind of the part that flows along the east coast of the U.S. And where does it get its heat? Well, it transports water from the tropics, and in the tropics, the water is heated by the incoming solar fluxes. And when these warm water masses are fastly moved upwards to the North Atlantic, then they just take their time before they slowly release the heat to the atmosphere. And thus, we have a transport of warm water masses towards the higher latitudes in the North Atlantic.
How does the Gulf Stream affect the weather along the American eastern seaboard and the maritime provinces of Canada, and in what seasons?
This is a really complex question you're asking there, because weather is determined by a variety of factors. And when looking at the Gulf Stream or the overturning circulation, we rather see effects on long-term climate. So I'm sorry, but I can't in-depth answer this. But what we know is, or what studies have already shown, is an effect on the sea level at the American East Coast.
So would it cause the sea level to go higher or lower if we have these changes in the flowing of the current?
It will actually lead to an increased sea level rise. So we have a sea level rise because warmer ocean water is expanding, and therefore under global warming we have a general sea level rise. But, and this is more complex, so I'll take some time to answer this. As you know, the Earth is rotating, and therefore we have on all moving things on Earth the Coriolis force acting. So this normally means on the northern hemisphere that when somebody is moving from the south towards the north, and it doesn't matter if this is me or you or an ocean current, it is forced to move towards the right-hand side. And so for a current to move from the south to the north without being deflected this much, the sea surface has to tilt, with lower sea levels at the U.S. coast and higher sea levels in the mid-Atlantic, and then you have a force acting from the mid-Atlantic towards, from the high sea levels towards the low sea levels, which can counteract this Coriolis force. So this is one point. Then the Coriolis force is stronger when the current is faster. Therefore, this tilt has to be more steep when the current is faster. Now, as the current weakens, the Coriolis force gets weaker and the tilt and sea level height also becomes smaller. And this leads in the mid-Atlantic to lower sea levels, but at the U.S. East Coast to higher sea levels. Well, this is a physical mechanism that is actually, it's simple when you know about it, and it's kind of nice to really understand because it's a simple link. And this, yeah, has already been seen that we have increased sea level rise at the U.S. coast due to slower ocean currents.
I learned a lot from what you just said. Okay, your paper's mainly about the velocity of Atlantic Ocean currents, but is the Gulf Stream also changing its location or direction?
Okay, so what we show in our study is actually that there is a change in the location of the Gulf Stream. This is actually also basic physics. So, as I said, the overturning circulation is weakening, and this means that also this deep southward return flow from high latitudes towards the tropics is weakening. And when this deep return flow is kind of following the east coast of the U.S. and then it downslopes at the area of the Gulf of Maine due to the bottom topography there, it leads due to what we call vorticity conservation, which is also related to the Earth rotating. It kind of causes the Gulf Stream to deflect from the U.S. coast because it induces another recirculation gyre there. So this is complex, but the main point is the deep return flow causes the Gulf Stream at some point to deflect from the U.S. coast. And when this return flow becomes weaker, the Gulf Stream can actually follow the coastline a little bit further north and then deflect later towards mid-Atlantic. So we see an effect on the Gulf Stream. But you have to keep in mind that the Gulf Stream is also forced by wind changes or by the winds in the atmosphere over the Atlantic. And so changes in the Gulf Stream are not just due to changes in the overturning circulation, but other changes, for example, in the wind forcing will also show in the Gulf Stream. So it would also be great to study just the Gulf Stream itself in more detail, because now we focus on the overall overturning circulation.
There was a second study published in the same issue of Nature in April 2018, led by David Thornalley of the University College London. How does that relate to your study?
Well, basically, Thornalley and colleagues also looked at different climate parameters to infer information about the evolution of this overturning circulation in the Atlantic, but they went further back in time. So they used what we in climate science we call proxies from different core sites. So proxies means you can't measure something directly and you look at other parameters to get information. So they had a temperature-based proxy, and then they also used salted fill data. And the salted fill data basically gave them information about the current velocities of the deep flow of the Labrador seawater. So basically saying, depending on the size of the grains, you could kind of get information about how fast the current was. And they saw that this current got weaker towards the mid-19th century. Yet you have to keep in mind that this might not represent the full overturning circulation, because they used two core sites, and this is a rather local proxy then. Or they also looked at a temperature-based proxy with a little bit more data, which is similar like ours because it's based on the same idea, namely that when the overturning circulation in the Atlantic weakens, we have less heat being transported from the tropics to the high northern latitudes, and therefore you can see the cooling in the sea temperatures there.
Why do you say the change in the Atlantic overturning brought on by human-induced warming is greater than anything seen in the last 1,000 years?
Well, basically because that's what the data shows us. This relative temperature in the North Atlantic is colder as it was at any time in the last 1,000 years. So the temperatures in the North Atlantic with respect to the global mean temperature is really being at its deepest level right now, or its lowest level right now.
Yet, as Stefan Ramsdorf points out, a smaller ocean change in the currents appears at the end of the Little Ice Age, as it's called. Around 1860 was the end of it, and before a meaningful amount of fossil fuels were burned?
Well, this is correct, because the fossil fuels itself, or the burning of fossil fuels itself, is not the direct link to, or doesn't directly slow down the overturning circulation, but it is the increased melting of both Greenland ice sheet and the Arctic sea ice, so the increased meltwater flux into the ocean, into the North Atlantic Ocean, that is causing the slowdown of the overturning circulation. And we know that at the end of the Little Ice Age, or the so-called Little Ice Age, there was a time of increased melting of the Greenland ice sheet, presumably natural at that time, which then also caused a weakening in the overturning circulation, but that weakening wasn't as great as what we observe right now.
And you mentioned the melting of the Greenland ice sheet and the sea ice that is disappearing, but also increasing precipitation is a factor.
Yes, exactly, because increased precipitation over the North Atlantic and the surrounding land areas basically also leads to an increased freshwater flux into the North Atlantic due to the river runoff. And that is the point. It's the freshwater flux that is kind of hindering the engine, or what I would call the engine of the overturning circulation, namely that at some sites in the subpolar North Atlantic, you have places where water, due to it becoming cooler and being relatively salty, is so heavy at the surface that it has to sink down because the water layers below it are not as dense, So the dense surface water is sinking towards the deep ocean. And then if it's down there, it has to go somewhere, and then it flows south. So this is really what is keeping the overturning circulation going. And with this freshwater influx, the water is less salty. And if the water is less salty, it's not as dense, not as heavy, so it's more difficult for it to sink. And we therefore hinder the deep water formation that is driving the overturning circulation by increasing these freshwater fluxes into the northern Atlantic.
Radio EcoShock.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. My guest is Liefke Caesar from the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research in Germany. We're talking about a new paper in the journal Nature. It confirms the Great Atlantic Convection Current is weakening, with serious repercussions on both sides of the Atlantic and around the world. The press release from PIC, the Potsdam Institute, reports the Atlantic overturning current has reduced by about 15% since 1950. How do you know that, Liefke?
Well, what we really observe is the temperature change in the subpolar North Atlantic, what we call the subpolar gyre region, because it describes the location south of Greenland rather well, and we see the cooling there. And we know it's related to a weakened overturning circulation, bringing less heat into that region. And we then use an ensemble that is many different climate models, state-of-the-art climate models, to calibrate between the observed temperature change and the presumably change in the overturning strength that is causing this temperature change. And therefore, we can see, okay, looking at the observed temperature change, this relates or translates into a weakening of three threadrop since 1950, and that is 15% of the overall strength of the overturning circulation.
Right, and the Sverdrup is named after the Norwegian scientist Harald Sverdrup, and it's a measurement of ocean used in ocean science. And Wikipedia says the entire global input of fresh water from rivers to the ocean is equal to about 1.2 Sverdrups. And that would mean the reduction you're talking about in the ocean current in the Atlantic is about twice the total volume of all river water flowing into the sea around the world. That's a huge volume of change.
You're completely right. You have to keep in mind that we also talk about a huge current system. And I mean, just the width of the Gulf Stream is a couple of 100 kilometers, and then it goes down into deeper layers. But nevertheless, you're completely right. We're talking about lots of water being moved there or being not moved anymore.
Let's move on to Ireland and the UK. Liefke, how could a weaker Gulf Stream affect the weather there?
Well, this is complicated, and I have to admit that I'm not an expert talking about changes in weather. But what we know or what we think is that actually the winter surface air temperatures in Western Europe, if you look at them, they are up to 10 degrees higher than the zonal mean at the equivalent latitudes. So it's much warmer here than it is, for example, in Canada in wintertime. So, and this is largely due to the heat released by this ocean current system in the North Atlantic, and then the warm air is moved. The heat is transported toward Western Europe. So we do expect to have an effect there, but we have to study in more detail what exactly will happen.
Do you think the track of difficult and violent storms during winter in the United Kingdom in recent years could be related?
I think it could be, because model results, so studies have indicated that an AMOC decline will influence the storm tracks in Europe and could possibly intensify storminess in Europe. But I do believe that there's more in-depth research needed to confirm this.
A lot of countries have been researching this Atlantic meridional overturning current with good reason. The Americans have a program to monitor AMOC. Another's called RAPID, operating with British funding, and the Hadley Center in the UK. How do your results compare with what they find?
Well, actually, we find the same decline in the overturning strength in our index that is observed by the RAPID program since 2004. That is when this program was implemented. So our results agree quite well with what has been measured. You just have to keep in mind that our index represents the longer-term changes of the overturning circulation, while the rapid program gives you high temporal resolution data. But nevertheless, the results agree rather well.
There's a buzz in science about a blob of cold water south of Greenland. That spot in the ocean is one of the few places on the planet that is cooling despite global warming. How does that relate to the paper that you led?
Well, basically, the weakening and the overturning circulation actually explains the cooling trend in that region. So you just have to keep in mind that when you look at a single winter, for example, and you have really cold temperatures then at that point, this will, of course, also be influenced by weather, so by the state of the atmosphere. But the long-term trend in that region and the missing warming, let me put it like that, can be explained by a weakening in the overturning circulation in the Atlantic.
How could record cold in the northern Atlantic in 2015 lead to a heat wave in Europe that summer?
Well, this is actually an interaction between ocean and atmosphere that's quite interesting. So when you have cold temperatures in the North Atlantic, so south of Greenland, then this will favor an air pressure distribution that spans around the whole globe at the northern high northern latitudes, and this air pressure distribution can channel warm air into Europe from tropical regions, and if it persists for quite some while, then you can actually have a heat wave because you have many days with warm air being channeled into Europe, and this can lead to a prolonged heat wave in Europe.
That's pretty amazing. Did this study predict how quickly Atlantic overturning may weaken in a hotter future?
No, we actually did not research that. I mean, there are climate models, and many climate models have simulated and how far the overturning circulation will change under different scenarios, so depending on how much carbon dioxide we release into the atmosphere in the future. But it's kind of difficult to model such an overturning circulation, and therefore they do disagree on how fast the overturning circulation will weaken. So they agree on the fact that it will weaken, and I mean, our study showed that it already started to weaken in response to the increased greenhouse gas emissions and the following global warming. But as I said, the models disagree on the timing of this weakening, so we should put more effort into studying this into more detail.
Now, I know this isn't included in your study, but I wonder if science has speculated on whether there's a breaking point where the Atlantic currents create a climate crisis, or is this just a slow process that gradually ramps up?
Well, it is a relatively slow process compared to, for example, weather happenings or weather events, but we know that there is a threshold in the overturning circulation, so at some point it really might more or less stop flowing. But here again, the climate models disagree on where this threshold is, so how much warming is needed for the overturning circulation to more or less collapse. And therefore, I just can emphasize the importance of studying this in more detail.
It does sound important. I know there has been speculation for decades that the Gulf Stream could weaken or maybe stop eventually. What do these two studies bring that is new to that discussion?
Well, in my opinion, they bring a really robust evidence that the overturning circulation has indeed already weakened, as predicted by climate models in response to global warming.
Lifka, what will you and your group at PIC be researching next?
Well, as you also already mentioned, is that we do know that or believe that there are influences from the overturning circulation on climate in Europe, in the U.S. and Canada. And personally, I would like to study the link between a decline in the overturning strength and its influences on weather in more detail. And my next project will actually be to study the link between the overturning circulation and extreme weather and extreme climate events. And, yeah, I'm both. I'm excited on what I will find, but I'm also a little bit afraid of what this will show me. And, yeah, so that's my next project.
It's exciting science, but it does affect millions of people and not necessarily in a good way. Is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
Yes, I guess I would just like to say that I hope that everybody takes human-made global warming seriously, because, I mean, it is true that there are a lot of things we don't completely understand yet, and we do not completely or exactly know what the future will bring us, but it's clear to me that we are affecting our climate at a rather rapid speed, and, I mean, yeah, so just trying to protect our Earth. That would be great.
We've been speaking with Liefke Caesar from the Potsdam Institute for Climate Impact Research, known as PIC, or P-I-K. The title of this important paper is Stronger Evidence for a Weaker Atlantic Overturning. It was published in Nature on April 11, 2018. Find links to the science we've been talking about, plus other helpful articles, in my radio show blog at ecoshock.org. Liefke, thank you for helping us understand these big changes.
Yeah, thanks for giving me the chance to explain everything in detail.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Forget about the 1.5-degree warming aspiration at Paris in 2015. There have already been two conferences of international scientists talking about 4 degrees of warming and beyond. What would happen? A new paper investigates what it could mean for Europe if we get to 1.5 degrees as hoped, or if we go all the way to 3 degrees warming, which could be devastating. Southern Europe could become, quote, a desert, and all European agriculture is threatened by long-lasting and frequent drought. We're talking about 740 million people. The paper published in Nature Climate Change is titled Anthropogenic Climate Warming Exacerbates European Soil Moisture Droughts. Our guest is the lead author, Dr. Luis E. Samaniego, senior researcher at the Helmholtz Center for Environmental Research, UFZ. From Leipzig, Germany, Luis Samaniego, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Oh, hello.
Why don't we begin with an event often used in your paper, the 2003 drought in Europe. Can you describe what happened then?
2003 was an unusual drought, started very fast, developed over a period of 7 months. It started in April or a bit earlier, and covered most of France and south of Germany, lots of parts of Spain. It's calculated, it's estimated that about, I would say, just approximately more than 1 billion euros were lost. It's a bit more. I don't have the exact figure. So 2003 was an unusual drought compared to the previous droughts in the 70s. It was a very fast drought. High intensity started early in the year and cover large parts of France, Spain, and Germany. It has also another effect, which was the highest temperature measure in that time. There are many science papers on this. It created also an enormous heat wave, which, according to some sources, was above 30,000 people. There's all casualties, mainly elderly, who could not support the heat overnight. So it was terrible for many reasons, and the low flows were also a problem. Many stations need to shut down, and electricity might become a problem. Drought is a terrible social problem at the end if you're not prepared, and especially in these kind of events, which are very fast. So that was 2003. From the greenhouse gases, there are studies quoted in the paper you mentioned, there was an enormous amount of release of carbon because plants that cannot absorb any more CO2 from the atmosphere. And in these months of the drought, it is estimated that you release so much carbon that you annihilate the work done by 4 years or 3 years of normal vegetation growth. So it has impacts in all aspects.
Yes, the climate feedback is amazing. I mean, normally plants do sequester carbon back into the soil and down into the roots, but in this case they couldn't. Does that present a positive feedback where higher temperatures can lead to more CO2 emissions from the land?
Yes, because plants tend to protect themselves if they have problems with our water supply in the roots and the temperature is too high. They close the stomata and they stop transpiring. So the whole cycle stops and the CO2 in the atmosphere remain high at high levels. And that will continue over days and over even months. So this is the feedback that the heat waves and the drought produce in respect to CO2.
Given your studies, is it possible the extreme drought of 2003 could become the new normal for parts of Europe if the world warms too much?
If that's what we found exactly, is to define a drought, we need to have a threshold. And the threshold we normally define, imagine a 2-meter depth column of water, of soil. 50% of the soil is more or less, let's suppose, is voids. So water can fill in on these voids that we call porosity. And at a certain level, if it's, let's say, 20% of that available water capacity, if the system is below this level, you call it a drought. It happens. You can see what happened with your, when you have a plant in your house and you've forgotten to water over days. Plants start dying and the stomata is closed and you are below the wilting point. In that moment, plants stop producing and transpiring and respiring. So this is the threshold we need to define to make an estimation of drought area and drought extent. But this is relative to every location and is depending on this period of time in which this threshold is defined. This threshold is going to change over time because the climate is non-stationary. So if you define this level, let's suppose over 1 meter, you are talking about 30 centimeters of water. Below that, you are now under drought. This is too high for the future because the warming in the future will increase transpiration, will increase evaporation, is going to be in some cases less precipitation. So the system will be below that level. So the threshold become too high, and that is what we call increase in aridity. The system as a whole will become drier, and the difference between these levels will show that the 2003 event will become somehow a normal situation in the future. It will not, in some cases, not even be accounted as a drought because the normal levels in the future will be lower. So it will be a normal summer, probably, in the 2070 or something. But, you know, the result of what happened to the system when you have that kind of summer, you can extrapolate and imagine how the system will become under that situation.
Your paper was written with a team of scientists, many of them from the Helmholtz Institute, but also others from Princeton, I believe, and Southampton University, and from the Netherlands. Why did your team spend so much time investigating the differences between what would happen with 1.5 degrees C of warming and then 3 degrees of warming?
This was crucial for us. The work was funded by the Copernicus Climate Change, basically, and we were delivering these simulations for them. Then having the simulations, we decided to investigate something that we didn't know before. Most people estimate drought areas and drought durations based on RCP, so a climate scenario. The problem with the climate scenarios is that every climate model has its own climatology inside. So some models reach 1.5 degrees, let's say in the 2040, whereas other models reach the 1.5 degree 10 years later or 10 years earlier. And so that means that you cannot use the emission scenario to estimate the drought duration and drought area. You need to mix up all the simulations regardless of the emission. So that's what we did, and figure out at what point in time this model, the global temperature will increase by 1.5 degree, and that is the sensitivity we were trying to estimate. So we referenced to the absolute change in temperature and look what happened with the soil moisture and the properties we were trying to estimate so that we can, for first time, analyze the sensitivity of change in temperature to change in drought area, which was not done before because it's a very time-consuming task. It's heavily demanding from the numerical side because you have to handle 60 different simulations that we have in this system. And each simulation is a quite large number of calculations to obtain.
And the results are somewhat different for different parts of Europe, of course. And suppose the world warms by 3 degrees C as a global mean. What does that mean for Spain and its 46 million people?
So for the Mediterranean in general, it's going to be quite complicated. The number of, for example, the change in aridity that we estimated will increase in almost all seasons. And in all degrees of warming, from 1.5 to 3, it's just a matter of how much is the level. So the conclusion is, and all of these changes are significant. They are not statistically significant. That means that winter is going to have less, it will have a change. It's going to be even drier. That means that the whole cycle, the whole water cycle, will become affected. They will have less amount of rain in winter, less snow in the mountains. That will create also problems in the summers, water supply of the rivers and the cities. The evaporation at the same time will increase because temperature is increasing. Evaporation of a free land will increase, so it's a vicious circle, and the whole thing will pop up. So consequences that they will lose about the deficit in the worst case, in the worst in drought, will be about 35 millimeters in average. And this is an enormous amount of water. 35 millimeters deficit in a column of 1 meter, 2 meters, translated to the space means 35,000 cubic meters per square kilometer. Just imagine the magnitude of this deficit in the worst drought. 2017, last year, Spain had also a horrible drought. About 38% of the reservoirs were half empty, and they didn't have enough water for irrigation. Imagine the deficit of 35,000 cubic meters per square kilometer. It's a reservoir of 100 by 100 by 3.5 meters high. Every square kilometer is missing this amount of water. So agriculture and normal rain-fed agriculture under these conditions cannot be realized. You need to have a sophisticated equipment, probably, or irrigation systems that are drip irrigation. Everything is possible, but it's extremely expensive, and people should start thinking where the water has to be stored. You cannot store in dams. You see what is happening at the moment. Dams become empty by end of the year. And next year, again, the same problem. And then you are expecting to have a winter to replenish the reservoirs. And in winter, it's not raining again. You will have long droughts. And at some point, the system will break down. This is what probably, that's the horror scenario I see. Of course, there's going to be some gains for other regions in Europe. That's basically the boreal parts, and the boreal and the Scandinavia will have the opposite situation. They might get in winter more water. Freezes and precipitation will lead to higher low flows, and that means that they will store water. But for the south, it's a sad situation. If these climate models are in the right path, and this is what is going to be, it's not a nice future, I would say, for everyone.
Now, in between a possibly wetter Scandinavia and a very dry south, you have previously published on the hydrology of Germany. What are the new projections for water availability for Germany under 3 degrees of warming?
It's going to be different from what is now is going to have a hot summers and we're going to have less water, but not comparable to what is in the south. I don't have the figure in mind, but if you check the amount of average number of months per year is going to increase from, let's say, 1 month per year, assuming the old threshold, 1 month per year will increase to 3 months per year in the south of Germany, in Goodbury, and northwest and northeast will be probably a bit drier than other places because of the characteristics of the soil and rainfall patterns. It's going to be also different because Germany does not have any, almost no infrastructure for irrigation. And so having a 1 month extra deficit might create also problems for the plants living in this environment and for the agricultural systems, which are mainly based on rain-fed agriculture. Going to be a problem for maize plantations, for example. 2015 was a problem. We wrote a paper on this, and it was not a big drought, but it was enough to reduce 10% of the crop yield. And it was just a minor drought, so to say, compared to 2013. And these droughts we have measured since 2000 or 1970s compared to the future droughts are not comparable. It's, what is coming is probably much larger and stronger and larger magnitudes.
Europe produces a lot of food, and agriculture is extremely important in this picture. And one of the recurring themes in this new paper is the possibilities of adaptation to coming changes in Europe. Are there other kinds of adaptation other than, say, irrigation and better water storage that we should be thinking about now?
I think we should start thinking on probably different kinds of storage for water supply and for irrigation, probably underground storages to avoid evaporation during summers. We cannot count with groundwater. That is extremely expensive. We cannot start pumping groundwater. It's, first of all, it's quite expensive. You need electricity. Second, it's protected by law in Europe. You can't just pump. You need permissions. That is likely not going to be accepted. And then it's a resource that is not refilled in the next year. It's water reaching the groundwater level takes years to be there. So we need to find out other methods. Probably sophisticated techniques for agriculture will make possible to have same levels of production having drip irrigation. The Israelis have already very sophisticated methods. But as I said, this is not for enormous extensions. Germany has large areas of agriculture, France the same, and Spain the same. And high-tech agriculture is quite expensive. I don't know what consequences would have. You need to ask the experts in agriculture production what these are the consequences. What we concentrate was to estimate the deficit from the point of view of the hydrology and meteorology. But I guess it's going to be highly complicated to supply.
It sounds like a big experiment we're running on the Earth. Do we really know what's coming?
Well, that's exactly right. We're running an unknown experiment on the only planet we have. You know, if somebody were to propose doing this kind of experiment, they would be locked up as crazy because it's the only planet we have. And yet that's the experiment we're doing without knowing fully what the consequences are.
The world. This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex with my guest, Dr. Louis E. Samaniego from the Helmholtz Center for Environmental Research in Leipzig, Germany. We're talking about drought as the new normal in much of Europe if global warming goes, say, beyond 2 degrees C. And your paper points at an important problem that much of our planning and our thinking is based on increasing heat only, but water is really the key to life, isn't it?
Right. Without water, we can't live. Plants will die in a couple of weeks, and our water supply for cities is coming basically from the exfiltration from the soil, and that will create a drought in the rivers, and the rivers will get low flows, reservoirs will be empty. Having low levels in soil moisture would also imply to have a drought in the groundwater levels, so the levels in groundwater will decrease, and replenishing groundwater is a problem. It takes a long time to do. So it's going to be a big problem how you manage the water resources in Europe if the warming continues. And that probably can be extrapolated to any other semi-arid region in the world. We hope in the future to do similar analysis, but I would say it's the same kind of pattern that you will observe.
That was one of my thoughts on reading this paper, the research that should be done on the impact of drought on cities, because if longstanding drought becomes normal in southern Europe, we may see cities rationing water, as recently happened in Rome, or even run out of water, like Cape Town in South Africa.
That's my thinking. We have been trying and expending too much water. We probably need also to think on efficiency systems, so increase the efficiency of the water supply. Every drop of water has to be protected, recycled, and take care about this thing. We cannot just spend water. Water quality will be the second issue that we will have. Low levels in reservoirs increase other problems. It leads to eutrophication, for example. It might lead also to algae blooms, and that increases the costs of treatment. At the same time, you can treat the water, but you need more electricity. But the thermal stations and the nuclear plants cannot produce electricity if they don't have cooling systems. So it becomes a vicious circle. You will not have the electricity unless you start burning more fuel from fossil fuels, or you need to probably start doing desalinization to supply water. But that's also very expensive, and you need a lot of energy, solar energy probably, which again needs investment. So it's a very complicated problem. I think the study was trying to make a warning and say, look what is coming. We should start thinking what we are going to do in the future, how to administrate and how to operate and plan the new infrastructure so that this collapse that you mentioned in Cape Town, for example, or Rome, do not happen every year in the south of Europe.
You know, when there was a major drought in Australia in the Murray-Darling Basin, some of the farmers there were so discouraged that they did commit suicide, and there's a lot of tension on the whole social fabric when things are too hot and too dry for too long. I think that's another factor, the social stress that is underlying in the information in your paper.
Yeah, we were trying to make some remarks on this side. We were advised not to speculate. Personally, I think drought induces migration. I have seen this in my life. I come from a region where drought was a big problem, social problem. You mentioned the problem in Australia. We can have lots of examples in the United States and even in Germany at some point. It's going to be a social problem. And if you have 1 year, you probably can survive a drought. You have still resources to do perhaps next year. But if the drought is recursive and is coming again and again, and the plant level of production is decreasing, you will have people that is despaired, and they probably migrate somewhere else. So you might create a horrible social problem as a result of these droughts. And we know what happened. It's a terrible, terrible social problem.
Yes, and migration it's already such a hot issue in Europe, migration, that it's, it can even determine elections. Now, your paper concludes, and I'd like to quote here, "Further research is urgently needed to assess the degree of impact of future extreme drought events on the European society as a whole."
Any modeling with respect to what happened with population, for example, demographics, what happened with the electricity networks, what happened with transportation networks, what happened with water supply networks under this kind of a stress. This was not covering this, and that's what I mean here by European society as a whole. These systems are extremely complex to manage, and a little disturbance in one of them leads to non-linear transformations in the others, which probably end up in catastrophic situations. So we need to do further research to understand these disturbances, what are the consequences of such a big disturbance in the future, and what implication it have for all the systems we have, electricity networks, as I said, and all the supply that we need. And this is not done. And we also don't know how people will react. We need to investigate how people will live under such a condition. Heat waves, which will be longer, with temperature above the levels that people have been used to live. Living in cities that probably were not planned to be livable under such a high temperature. If you go to the North Africa, you have cities with a different architecture. If you are in middle of Spain, you don't have that kind of architecture. Or if you're in France, it's a different thing, or Germany. If you have above 25 degrees at night in Germany, over a week, people start despairing and thinking to buy air conditioning. We don't have air conditioning. And that's the kind of thing we need to investigate. And we need to know, for example, with other experts to, for example, do modeling with respect to mortality and just try to estimate what kind of situations might happen under such a huge increase in temperature and drought. And on top of that comes the modeling on the vegetation and greenhouse gases and all the combination of all. So it's still an open question for me. I don't know. It needs to be done because otherwise we cannot take decisions and make the planning necessary to confront this change.
And also we have to convince the public that this is real and it's imminent and we have to do something about it. Now, as we get close to wrapping up here, we can't go into too much technical detail, but I am interested if you could give us a glimpse of your project to create what is called a mesoscale hydrologic model. For the public, what is that?
So when I started hydrology some 15 years ago, I saw the need of having a model that is portable from location A to location B and a different scale. So I need to develop a model that can be used anywhere and with a least amount of investment, human investment, to calibrate the model and to reproduce the water cycle in this location. So this is called mesoscale because it should work at the intermediate scale between, let's say, 1 kilometer and 10 kilometers. Each grid side is in that order, so it should be small enough to generate ideas that are useful for planning. And every square kilometer or less, we could estimate with this model the available water in the soil, the amount of water that is produced as a runoff, and we can estimate the amount of groundwater recharge and the amount of evaporation. That's the basic components that we have. And it should work everywhere. The model has been tested in Europe, in the United States, and recently it was in Australia. We ran it for first time for Australia. We are going to have some runs for the whole globe and perhaps at the end of the year. This is the main concept. It has a property that it can run at different scales at the same time so that you can verify the fluxes that the model estimate using satellite information that comes at different scales, some of them quite large, like GRACE, others a bit finer, like MODIS data, which provides information on land surface temperature. So the model has the ability to be multi-scale at the same time. And with this amount of features, we were able to do the simulations over Europe and for this study. Yeah.
And as we finish up, given this recent study, Luis, is there a final message you would like to leave for all the people of Europe?
Well, I would say climate change is something that we can verify with the facts, and it's not a matter for me of not believing or not or believing. This is beyond that level. And there are facts, and the facts is called science. And the science we do is based on observations. The data we obtain is based on 100 years of daily information. That's how we build up the historical records over thousands of rainfall stations and temperature stations and stream flow gauges. Based on that is how we calibrate models like MHM. And if we are able to reproduce the historical record, then we are able to say something what's going to happen. So I think European society needs to realize that something must be changed in the way we live and the way we use water. And we need to take now the responsibility for our children to say we cannot continue with this exuberant way of life. We cannot burn fossil fuels forever. We should stop that as soon as possible. We need to reduce our CO2 footprint, and we need to increase the efficiency of the water supply network and the way how we deal with all this. So it demands a change in our, probably even in our traditions, how we deal with the whole system.
We have been talking with Dr. Luis E. Samaniego. He is a senior researcher at the Helmholtz Center for Environmental Research, UFZ, in Leipzig, Germany. Luis is the lead author of the new paper, Anthropogenic Warming Exacerbates European Soil Moisture Droughts. It was published in the journal Nature Climate Change on April 23, 2018. You can find links to the science and articles about the new regime of drought in Europe if warming continues in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Luis, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
Thank you, Alex. A pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
I've been waiting for the stage of science where we can focus on continents and even parts of continents with accurate predictions. Here we have it for European water supplies, for agriculture, for cities, and for society. The costs of a transition away from fossil fuels are big. The costs of adapting, as we heard, even to produce food, are very large. And the cost of doing nothing is disaster for our civilization, our species, and all species. We cannot allow rampant climate change to happen. That is the message and purpose of this program. I'm Alex, saying thank you for listening, and thank you for caring about our future.
Frankly, what's happening in the Arctic is unprecedented because it affects the rest of us around the world in all sorts of ways, from changes in storm patterns, changes in circulation flows in the ocean. There are political implications of the rapid changes in the Arctic. It's a harbinger of things to come, and I think we all need to be worried about it. And for those scientists who focus on the Arctic, there's tremendous concern. I think there's really universal concern among Arctic scientists and among climate scientists that what's happening in the Arctic is not only unprecedented, not only an indication of the kinds of changes we're going to continue to see in the coming decades, but that those changes are bad.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
The Israeli security officials at the airport have outsourced to these right-wing Zionist, unreliable, lying, troll websites the job of sorting who's a security risk and who isn't.
It's clearer that we were targeted because of the company we keep rather than the work that we do.
The academic boycott in particular, I think, is very powerful because I think the movement emerged at a time when academics were beginning to get slightly fed up of the censorship.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, and you're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast. Israel continues to racially profile, detain, interrogate, deny entry to, and deport people of Palestinian origin, Arabs and Muslims, Jewish activists, Quakers, students, human rights advocates, UN officials, and supporters of the boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign. Over the weekend, that denial of entry list was extended to Vincent Warren, the executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and Catherine Franke, chair of CCR's board and a professor of law, gender, and sexuality studies at Columbia University. Warren and Franke were traveling as part of a fact-finding delegation to witness the human rights situation in Palestine. The delegation brings together mostly black and brown civil and human rights leaders working on domestic U.S. justice issues, according to CCR. They were detained on April 29th for 14 hours and interrogated at Ben-Gurion Airport, then denied entry into Israel and deported back to New York. Warren and Franke were questioned about their political associations with human rights groups that have been critical of Israel's record, CCR says. As Israeli agents detained, interrogated, and then deported Warren and Franke on Sunday, Israeli occupation forces killed three Palestinians in Gaza, including a child, in two separate incidents. Since the Great March of Return protests launched on March 30th, at least 50 Palestinians have been killed in Gaza's eastern perimeter. Five of those killed were children and two were journalists. The vast majority were participating in protests when they were fatally injured by Israeli sharpshooters. Today is May 2nd, and as of press time, no Israelis have been killed or injured as a result of the protests. The protesters are demanding an end to Israel's siege of Gaza and the right of return for Palestinian refugees expelled and excluded from lands now in Israel because they are not Jewish. We're now joined by Vince Warren and Catherine Franke from New York City. Vince and Catherine, thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
It's our pleasure.
So, Vince, let's start with you. Before we get into what happened with you and Catherine being detained and deported, talk about this delegation, what you're hoping to do in Palestine, especially as the executive director of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I was really excited about this delegation. The first time I had been to the region was in January 2016. And as part of that, I led a delegation of lawyers and legal academics to meet with lawyers and legal academics in Israel and Palestine who had been challenging those laws. And as building on that, what became clear was that there are many more voices in the United States that we should be connecting to this struggle. And so what was exciting about this delegation, it was a delegation of mostly black and brown civil and human rights leaders, some of whom were lawyers, some of whom are activists, some of whom work very deeply in community, and a very broad and diverse one. We had people from Puerto Rico. We had Native American folks who had been working on Dakota Access Pipeline, Black Lives Matter activists working in the South, people working from Ferguson, people connected to the Women's March. It was really a tremendous set of people that most of whom had never been to the region before that were about to experience, what I found to be one of the most devastating weeks of my life, the first time that I went and met with all of the freedom fighters and human rights fighters on the ground there.
So you were both at first cleared at the airport and then snatched back into interrogation rooms by Israeli agents. Catherine, can you explain what happened to you and what kind of questions they began asking you?
Well, after we were held in detention for about an hour and a half or so, maybe longer, you lose track of time when you're in this kind of space. I was brought into an interrogation room and was asked some pretty routine questions at first about how often had I been to Israel, when was the first time, what was the purpose of my trip. I answered all those questions. The purpose of the trip was tourism, and I was coming in part of a group. The interrogation took a turn, a very hostile turn, I would say. And the man declared, "You're here to promote BDS in Palestine, aren't you?" And I said, "No, I'm not." And inside I was sort of chuckling because you don't promote BDS in Palestine. That's not where the work is done. But in any event, this delegation had nothing to do with BDS. We were not boycotting Israel. We were coming there to meet with people and witness what the kinds of work and they were doing in the lives of Palestinians and the Arab minority within Israel. So I truthfully answered that question. And he said, "You're lying." He pointed his finger at me and he yelled at me, you're lying, you're a big liar, I know you're here, you're to promote BDS in Palestine, and you're a leader of the BDS movement. And I said, I am not. I'm sorry you think that, but I am not. And at that point, he took his cell phone where he had Googled me and turned it around towards me and showed what I know is one of these right-wing Zionist troll websites. And he said, see, you're lying to me. I have proof. You're here to promote BDS in Palestine. And I said, I'm sorry you're using that as a source. But that is not what I'm here to do. We are here to see the holy sites, to meet with people here in Israel, and to tour as tourists, not to promote a political project. And at that point, there was no way for me to redeem myself. Really, the point of the interrogation from his perspective was to get me to admit that I was there as part of a boycott project. He also tried to tie me to JVP and say, you work for JVP, don't you? And I said, no, I don't. I don't work for JVP. Then the accusations that I was lying continued. It was a very aggressive interrogation. It lasted about an hour where really all he did is tell me that I was a big liar. He insulted me in other ways. My ears were backed up from the flight and I was having trouble hearing him. And I asked him if he could speak up. And he said, well, your hearing would improve if I threw you in prison, wouldn't it? And I said to him, wow. I really think that's unnecessary. I'm trying to answer your questions truthfully. And I just got off a very long flight and I'm tired and having trouble hearing. So at some point he took the little piece of paper that is our visa, the visa for getting into Israel, crumpled it with his hands and threw it on the floor. And he said, I'm deporting you and banning you for life from returning to Israel. And he made me take my he took a picture of me and then did a fingerprint a scan of both of my index fingers and kicked me out of the room.
And then you were put into a detention room for the remaining 13 hours or so?
You know, Vince and I had somewhat different experiences. At one point we were separated, but I say for the next several hours we were together and we were moved around the airport. We were moved into another holding area in that passport control hall. Then they took us through a kind of mystery door into the backside of the airport through a dirty hallway and upstairs and down another hallway that had broken chairs and tables in it. And then into a kind of a crummy conference room sort of setting where there were probably 15 other people, all of whom were speaking Russian or Ukrainian. I can't tell the difference because I don't speak either of those languages. I think we were the only English speaking people there. And they actually had the TV blaring, Israeli TV, but a Russian station with a loop of news and then soap operas, which the Russian-speaking people were enjoying, but we were not. And then at another point, I was moved somewhere else to scan my baggage. And when I came back, Vince was being taken away, and I didn't see him again until we were on the plane.
When they took me away, it was an interesting thing. So one of the things I've learned in my work, working in jails and different places like that, it's not always the uniformed people that you need to worry about. It's the folks in the T-shirts or the suits. And so the guy that came in was very big, burly. You could tell he was ex-military. And he was calling out a bunch of names, including mine. And so one of the questions that you have in these detention areas is, should I take my bags when you're asking me to go someplace or should I leave them? And, you know, you can't always tell what's going to happen. But usually if they say you should leave them, that means that you're coming back to the place possibly that they're taking you from. This time he said you should bring your bags. And so I had a sense that I was going to detention. Now, as it turns out, Catherine had received, in addition to her fingerprinting and such, she'd received at least some formal notification of she was not being allowed in the country. I did not receive any of that at all. And in my interrogation, which had happened in the secure area, I was asked basically to say that Catherine was a leader of the BDS movement. And when I said, of course she's not, he basically called me a liar and didn't listen to anything else that I had to say. So the man that was taking me to the detention center had a stack of passports and a stack of papers. My paper was on the top, and I could see that it said something about denial of entry. So I said to him, I need a copy of that paper because I've not been told why I've been denied entry into the country. And he said in very typical jailer fashion, he says, hey, do you want to stay here? You can stay here. I said, no, I don't want to stay here. I just want a copy of my paper. Says it sounds like you want to stay here. So you can either come with me or you can stay. I had asked for the paper four or five times, and it was clear to me that I was not going to be getting it from this person. So I went with him. He put me and along with me, there were two women and two men. The men were Russian and Ukrainian in the back of a van. We then were in the van, which had bars on it and different things like that, for a number of minutes to another building where we went into the detention center. The women were in a cell that were upstairs. The men were in the cell that was downstairs. In my particular cell, there were about eight bunks. There were a number of men in there, all of whom were Russian or Ukrainian, most of whom I don't think knew each other. And I sat there for a number of hours until I was finally brought to the back to the airport to catch my flight. An interesting thing about the flights, though, that I've learned since then has been initially there was a discussion there that we were booked on a Turkish Air flight that rather than United flight. We had flown United there and we had arranged to catch the United flight that evening. There was a fair amount of convincing to tell the guards that do not put me on the Turkish Air flight because that's not where I'm going. But when I got to the airport, I looked at the departures schedule, and there was our flight at 11:10, and there was a Turkish Air flight, but it was going to Istanbul. And what I've learned subsequently is that for people who have flown to Israel and then are deported, in that context, they usually get deported in the same route that they came. And that very often I've heard from a number of people that they, Israeli military or Israeli intelligence or immigration speaks to the local intelligence person, and you can be questioned or brutalized or beaten all over again. So at some level, being able to advocate for being on a direct flight back to the U.S. might have saved me some additional, certainly humiliation at best, and badgering at best, and even being brutalized at worst.
That's the voice of Vince Warren. Also with us is Catherine Franke. You know, you're both obviously involved in work at the Center for Constitutional Rights to advocate for human rights. And part of your work also is advocating for activists and lawyers who do activism on Palestinian human rights issues. Do you think that CCR's work triggered the Israeli apparatus to come after you after initially letting you through to baggage claim? Is there any indication that you two who are involved with CCR were targeted because of the work that CCR is involved in?
But from my perspective, it's not clear that it was CCR as such. I think it's clearer that we were targeted because of the company we keep rather than the work that we do and their characterizations of the company that we keep. I challenged the person who was interrogating me to point to something on the internet that would justify under the Israeli laws of admission, why I shouldn't be admitted as a tourist, and he couldn't do it at all. So that leads me to suggest that it was actually less about the work and it was more about the relationships, which is a tremendous problem, and for a variety of reasons. But I think it also speaks to perhaps how the Israeli government is beginning to expand its notion of who are problematic actors from people that may have done something problematic, at least for the from the perspective of Israel, to people that are connected to or that are friends with or they're traveling with folks in that arena. And it's always a troubling question when a government decides to broaden and loosen its requirements, because it makes it impossible to figure out whether you can get in, and it makes it impossible to fight how you can why the government is doing the wrong thing.
Yeah, I think my experience also made it clear that that the Israeli security officials at the airport have outsourced to these right-wing Zionist, unreliable, lying, troll websites the job of sorting who's a security risk and who isn't. If I were Israeli, I would worry about that because that's pretty shoddy work on their part. To take this kind of ideological perspective on security. But I also think the fact that they were so obsessed with whether I was a leader of the BDS movement and whether I work in some way with JVP says to me that these political movements have actually been very successful, that the Israeli government is that worried about JVP and about BDS. And it sends a signal in a way that they're incredibly vulnerable, or they perceive themselves to be so vulnerable that with people like us showing up to just witness and testify to what we see, that somehow the Israeli government or Israeli society will crumble. So I do think we've reached, or we're witnessing, a kind of tipping point in the kind of tactics that the Israeli government will use in order to seal off their own policies from critique. But also a tipping point in the effectiveness of a tactic like BDS or other ways in which the human rights record of Israel is being called out in the international community.
Catherine, were you able to catch any of the names of these websites that the officer held up to you on a phone?
It was just on his phone. There were a couple of them. Canary Mission is the one that likes me the most, I'm most popular on. Amcha is another, A-M-C-H-A, is another. They list me there. But, you know, to be honest, I'd say two-thirds of the arts and sciences faculty at Columbia University is on the Canary Mission website. There are also a lot of students from Columbia that are on that site. And the use of those sites by the Israeli security or immigration officials raises a very important issue of academic freedom as well. That will be banned simply by association with any of the organizations that they think are so dangerous means that our students can't go to Israel and work with other students or faculty there. It means our faculty can't travel. It creates a real problem for us in the U.S., but I also think it's a real problem for Israeli academics that they can't collaborate with people like myself. I have colleagues there who I would like to be working with, but I can't.
And actually, that leads me to my next question. Catherine, you mentioned on Democracy Now! This morning that Lee Bollinger, the president of Columbia University, was leaving the airport as you were being detained. Columbia is one of the many higher institutions around the U.S. that have ties to Israeli institutions, either through research grants or collaborations. And Columbia, as you said, is planning on opening a global center in Tel Aviv, a center that Palestinian students at Columbia or students in the occupied West Bank or Gaza Strip won't be able to visit or take part in research at because they won't be let into Israel. And now that that'll go for you, too, as you mentioned, and your colleagues who dare to speak out against Israeli policies or advocate for Palestinian rights. And actually, on this podcast, in the next segment here, we'll be speaking with a professor at UC Davis who wrote a book on the need for an academic boycott to, among other things, be able to address this kind of discrimination through these partnerships between U.S. and Israeli institutions. What can you say about the way these travel restrictions affect your students and colleagues? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Well, the travel restrictions are hugely prohibitive of cross-cultural international collaborations. We have many Israeli students here at Columbia who are here for a year or for a shorter visit or to get their undergraduate or graduate degrees. We can't get Palestinian students into the U.S. because the Israelis won't give them a permit to exit the West Bank, Gaza, or East Jerusalem. So my primary concern is with their capacities to travel, and my secondary concern is with our ability to go see them. But the most important thing is, I think, for Palestinian students and faculty to be able to get out of the West Bank and collaborate on whatever kinds of projects. It could be literature, it could be poetry, it could be film, it could be human rights. But, you know, the range of things that we're all working on are undermined by these travel restrictions. You know, you often hear a critique of BDS as the on the grounds that it somehow impedes academic freedom, that it censors certain voices. Well, actually, these travel restrictions are a much more effective way for the Israeli government to insulate Israelis from an international dialogue about a range of things, and also to sequester Palestinians, in the case of Gaza, in an open-air prison, but in the West Bank, in a context where it's very difficult to collaborate with scholars internationally.
Vince, will being denied entry by the Israeli state mean the end of your work to advocate on behalf of Palestinian human rights? What's the next step for you?
Under no circumstance is my advocacy going to stop because of this. And I would also want to point out that and we're seeing parallels here in the United States. As Catherine was mentioning, academics are at risk. Human rights advocates and lawyers are at risk. Journalists at risk. And if you think about controlling the message by denying entry to people that are journalists, that are academics and human rights advocates, you're denying access to the very people who are going to ask the questions that need to be asked and unearth the things that need to be unearthed in order for things to be able to change. And so at some level, by targeting us and the cohort, and by now there are hundreds. Catherine and I have been on Twitter and people are like, welcome to the club, people that have been denied. But it's a very important and influential club. And one of our goals now has to ensure that folks like us, folks that come after us, journalists in particular, are able to go into that country and to be able to meet with the people that they need to make. If the questions don't get asked, we never know the answers. And then we're only stuck with a state narrative. And that doesn't work in the context of Israel. And it certainly doesn't work in the context of the United States.
And Catherine, same question to you.
This will not stop my work one bit. First of all, I supervise dissertations of a number of Palestinian graduate students. I'll continue to do that. We'll continue to fight to get back in to Israel. I mean, the thing here is that not only does the Israeli government control who has the capacity to visit Israel, but they also have the ability to control who visits Palestine. Whether it's the West Bank, East Jerusalem, or Gaza. The Palestinians have no control over their ability to welcome visitors, tourists, human rights defenders, or anybody. So we'll continue to work from New York on a challenge to this ban, both in our case, but more broadly in the case of all the people who are subject to the Israeli ban. And as I know your listeners are very familiar with, there are all sorts of ways in which in the U.S., people who are advocating for the rights of Palestinians or are critics of the state of Israel suffer a range of forms of discrimination or punishment for that political position or that political activism. And so CCR and others are working to protect the speech and political advocacy rights of Palestine's friends in the U.S., if I can say.
Well, we're going to leave it right there. That's the voice of Catherine Franke. She's a professor at Columbia University and on the board of the Center for Constitutional Rights. And Vince Warren, you are the executive director of CCR.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Diane Yentel, President and CEO of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, who takes a critical look at the Trump administration's effort to impose rent increases and work requirements on millions of poor families. Shakor Al-Jawani of the New York City Community Energy Cooperative, who describes how renewable energy and the cooperative model can work together to empower communities. And Maria Luisa Mendonça, director of the Network for Social Justice and Human Rights in Brazil, who maintains that a right-wing coup impeached Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff and has now imprisoned former President Lula da Silva. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The
The Israeli government of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is dropping its plan to deport thousands of African migrants after failing to find a willing country to take them. The government had planned to deport migrant men, primarily from Sudan and Eritrea, who crossed the Sinai Desert to enter Israel. Human rights groups filed a petition before the Israeli Supreme Court to halt the deportations that would have impacted 37,000 African migrants. According to the Washington Post, the deportation plan was thought to be unconstitutional by many legal observers. The migrants, who will now be able to renew their residency permits every 60 days, as they were before the deportation effort, claim they are seeking asylum in Israel and fleeing persecution. Earlier, Netanyahu had said that after failing to reach agreement with any country to accept the migrants, he would try to draft legislation that would permit the reopening of detention camps to house the refugees in Israel. However, Israel's Supreme Court has previously struck down legislation that permits such detention and ordered the facilities shut down. In the last 6 months, only 44 Syrian refugees have been permitted to be resettled in the United States, just a fraction of those welcomed in the previous 2 years. Once in office, President Donald Trump cut in half the number of refugees allowed to enter America. International Rescue Committee Vice President Hans van de Weerd insists the Trump White House is using every red tape measure they have to slow down the flow of arrivals. The slowdown comes as the Supreme Court is reviewing the constitutionality of Trump's travel ban from select Muslim nations. Before Trump entered the White House, the U.S. had accepted nearly 24,000 Syrian refugees from Jordan in 2016. Last year, the number of refugees accepted fell to 3,700. While Trump has restricted the number of Muslims entering the U.S., he allows a larger proportion of European Christians, whom he prefers, according to the Christian Science Monitor. In a meeting with lawmakers in January, the president described the nations in Africa and Central America that the migrants are fleeing as S-hole countries. As a candidate, Trump repeatedly called for a total shutdown of Muslims coming to the U.S. Fox News host Sean Hannity has amassed a $90 million real estate empire, owning over 800 homes in 7 states with the aid of U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development financing. Hannity, a friend and unofficial advisor to President Trump, worked with shady real estate speculator Jeff Brock, who was convicted of a criminal conspiracy to manipulate the sale of foreclosed properties. The Guardian newspaper reports that in 2012, a shell company linked to Hannity purchased 11 foreclosed homes in Georgia that had been purchased by Brock. Brock transferred the properties to corporate vehicles that sold them back to the Hannity-linked company at a profit. 4 years later, Brock pled guilty to charges of bank fraud and conspiracy for his role in rigging foreclosure auctions. Brock was sentenced to 6 months in prison and was forced to pay $160,000 in fines. An attorney for Hannity denied the millionaire Fox News host was aware of any fraud committed in dealing with Brock. Hannity's real estate investments were supported by HUD underwriting to the tune of $18 million in mortgages, funding that was renewed by HUD Secretary Ben Carson. Hannity, who makes $36 million a year from his radio and TV shows, was recently named in court as a client of Michael Cohen, Donald Trump's personal lawyer. Yet, the right-wing media star was condemned for defending Cohen and Trump on the air without disclosing to his audience that he also consulted Cohen for legal services relating to his real estate dealings. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
As many as 2 million public housing tenants could face rent increases if Congress approves a proposal made by the Trump administration's Housing and Urban Development Secretary, Ben Carson. Dr. Carson, a former neurosurgeon, announced his plan called the Making Affordable Housing Work Act on April 25th. The reform package would require households that receive federal housing subsidies to to pay 35% of their gross income in rent, up from the current 30% required, and triple the minimum monthly rent for the poorest families, from $50 to $150. The HUD proposal would also allow local public housing authorities to impose work requirements on renters. That effort is supported by President Trump, who signed an executive order mandating that federal agencies evaluate employment rules for most government welfare programs. With this initiative and others, the Trump administration and congressional Republicans aim to restrict access to federal social safety net programs and reduce the levels of assistance allocated to low-income individuals and families who qualify. Your reporter spoke with Diane Yentel, president and CEO of the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, who takes a critical look at HUD's efforts to impose rent increases in work requirements and the consequences for millions of poor Americans.
I think what's especially appalling about these proposed rent increases is that they target the very poorest people, including seniors and people with disabilities who are already often living on fixed incomes and are at significant risk of homelessness. The proposal would increase rents for households with high medical or high child care expenses by eliminating income deductions for those expenses. So the greatest burdens would be felt by seniors, people with disabilities, and families with young kids who tend to have those high costs. So I think it's appalling, and it's important to recognize that these attempts to raise those rents on the most vulnerable people are really part of a larger assault by this administration on the entire social safety net. And I think that this administration's proposals to take away what are already very limited benefits for health care, for food, and for housing from struggling families just months after giving massive tax cuts to wealthy people and corporations is really an astonishing level of hypocrisy.
I wondered if you would address Ben Carson's statement, where he talked about the justification for these rent increases, trying to get away from a system that he claims has introduced perverse incentives, discouraging employment by many public housing tenants. How do you respond to the idea that somehow the federal subsidies coming from HUD are discouraging people from being gainfully employed and earning larger incomes?
First of all, that kind of rhetoric is really unfortunate because it's a purposeful attempt to kind of separate out what some might consider the deserving poor from the undeserving poor, right? And when we look at who is receiving housing assistance today, the vast majority of them are seniors, they're people with disabilities, they are caretakers for people with disabilities or very young kids, or they are working, but they're working very low-wage jobs, the kind of jobs where you can't pay the kind of rents that are out there today, and the kind of jobs where often it can be difficult to kind of cobble together enough hours in a week or in a month to make ends meet. So creating arbitrary work requirements where you're setting kind of an arbitrary bar for the number of hours that need to be worked in a week, if that family isn't able to get that number of hours in that week or in that month and they fall below that bar, are we really proposing that that family should be evicted from their housing? I mean, who is that helping, especially in the midst of the type of housing crisis that we're in today? There are programs within Secretary Carson's purview, within the Department of Housing and Urban Development, that could work to help people increase their earnings, programs like something called the Family Self-Sufficiency Program. There's another program called the Section 3 program, and that requires local communities to use HUD dollars that create jobs to first offer those jobs to low-income tenants or other low-income residents in the community. That's a regulation that's really very loosely overseen. Secretary Carson could do much more on that. He could seek funding to take the Family Self-Sufficiency Program to scale, but he's not doing any of those things. Instead, he's proposing policies really that are punishing poor people for being poor.
Diane, I wanted to ask you about the impact of this increased rent and the work requirements. What's liable to be the outcome for some of these poor families that will be at the other end of this policy if it goes through Congress?
Well, so here's something that we've known about housing costs for decades and have had general agreement among housing experts and policymakers. And that is that if you're paying more than 30% of your income towards rent each month, you're considered to be cost burdened. It means that you have limited income left over for all of life's other necessities. When you're low income to begin with and you're paying more than 30% of your very limited income, you have even less left for things like healthy food or medicine to stay healthy or saving for the future, saving for college or saving for retirement. So what HUD is actually proposing to do here is to increase the rent burdens on some of the lowest income people across the country. For most residents of HUD's major rental programs, it would mean increasing their rent from 30% of their income up to 35% of their income. And from 30% of adjusted, where they make some adjustments for those high medical costs or childcare costs, to 35% of gross without any deductions at all. That's a really significant income for very low-income people. And for the very lowest, the poorest and the most vulnerable households that are in HUD-subsidized homes today, they typically pay what's called a minimum rent, which could be up to about $50 a month. For them, HUD is proposing a mandatory minimum rent of $150, so tripling the rent of literally the poorest and most vulnerable households. So any of this will mean that people will be at a much higher risk of not being able to pay the rent, facing possible eviction and possible homelessness.
That was Diane Yentel, President and CEO of the National Low Income Housing Coalition. Find more analysis and commentary on the Trump administration's effort to slash government social safety net programs for poor families by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In Albany, New York protest on April 23rd, dubbed Walk the Talk on Climate Leadership, drew more than 1,500 people, the city's largest climate action ever. A broad coalition of activists from across the state gathered that day to demand New York Governor Andrew Cuomo take action for a fossil-free world. At a training session the day before the rally and mass nonviolent civil disobedience action, one of the presenters was Shakur Al-Jawani, coordinator of the New York City Community Energy Cooperative and chairperson of Co-op Power, which is a network of community energy cooperatives. He described how different forms of renewable energy and the cooperative model can work together to empower communities with both energy independence and economic development. Shakur says renewable energy can provide good-paying jobs that workers can feel good about rather than contributing to the degradation of the environment. He adds that renewable energy co-ops are a good way to keep money circulating through low-income communities. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended the training and spoke with Shakur after his presentation.
Well, we're building a multi-race, multi-class movement for sustainable energy. And part of that is being able to set up a network of cooperatives where we can begin to make decisions about what our energy needs are in our local areas, and then be able to use our cooperative power to help finance those new solutions. So whether it's building a biodiesel plant made from recycled vegetable oil in Greenfield, or a worker co-op energy efficiency installation in Holyoke with Anahia, or putting solar arrays on low-income housing cooperatives as we're doing in New York City. It's an approach where each city can decide what their focus is and then use our cooperative power as a local area and as a region to be able to make our solutions work.
So who's funding this?
We fund it largely through our own efforts, I mean, and that's the power of it. We'll go out and get grants and some other things to try to supplement, get a grant to help do worker training or some other thing like that. But generally, we started with cooperative dollars, and then we use new ideas like bringing strategic tax investors that are looking for a tax break, and at the same time, concerned about their communities and their planet and want to figure out a way to support innovative approaches. And so we use those to help us finance initially on the solar array, like putting a 7.9 kilowatts on the Nazareth housing on the East 11th Street in the Lower East Side, and then do an approach where we will buy that investor out within 5 to 7 years, and then either keep it in the cooperative or sell it back at extremely good rate to the particular building organization that it's a part of.
It sounds like you work right now mostly in New York and Massachusetts. Is that right?
Yes, and we're also doing work in Burlington, Vermont. Put a solar array on top of the food cooperative in Burlington, Vermont.
I've been to Burlington and I've been to the co-op. That's great. That's, okay. That seems like a good fit.
Yep.
So I just wonder, in the states where you have been working, are there state policies that are helping or hindering the development of this great-sounding project?
We started out in Massachusetts, and for a good bit of time, Massachusetts has, you know, along with California, a leader in the country for green energy. And there's been some backsliding on that, but we've developed a network, and we have an approach where we try to connect up with folks inside those bureaucratic systems that are trying to make a difference, and they're there, and figure out ways of how we can squeeze the most good out of whatever policies that a state has. So.
And what about utilities? In Connecticut, we've been trying to get shared solar year after year at the General Assembly, and I don't know, there's some hope we're going to get it this year, but every other year, the utilities have just opposed it so fiercely, and they throw a lot of money at it, and we haven't been able to get it through, even though it's very common in a lot of other states.
It's a problem. This situation is slowly improving, but way too slowly. And we've done the same where, you know, where we try to develop a good working relationship with those folks inside of, whether it's Con Edison in New York City or Eversource or Wormeco or some of the others. But it's a difficult battle, and we see now that not only got to work to provide the positive solutions, but we got to stand shoulder to shoulder with folks that are out there fighting to open some doors so that renewable energy is really supported and given the chance so that it needs to be able to make a difference. And then we have to figure out a way of how to retrain people in jobs of the future that makes sense. And not only are we creating jobs, but we're able to create wealth and bring that money from the sun creating energy on our roofs, that money can stay in the community instead of going to some investors in some other place. It's important for us to look at the power of cooperatives and the power of solar energy and other renewables as a way of making a difference and hopefully being able to stop the aggressive growth of climate change.
That was Shakur Al-Jawani, coordinator of the New York City Community Energy Cooperative and chairperson of Co-op Power, speaking at a training session before the April 23rd civil disobedience action demanding climate leadership from New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. Learn more about what climate activists are doing in New York by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. The imprisonment of Brazil's popular former president, Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, on April 7th appears to have completed what many observers charge is a successful right-wing coup undertaken against the nation's Progressive Workers' Party leadership. Lula, who had been a leading presidential candidate in this October's national election, is now serving a 12-year sentence on corruption and money laundering charges, even as he continues to appeal his case. Brazil's first female president, Dilma Rousseff, also of the Workers' Party, succeeded Lula as president in 2011 and won a second term in office in the 2014 election. However, she was impeached from office by the Brazilian Senate in August 2016 on charges that she violated fiscal regulations by using funds from state banks to cover budget shortfalls in order to continue funding popular anti-poverty programs. The charges of corruption in the Lava Jato or car wash investigation have eroded support for the Workers' Party
and other major parties and politicians across Brazil. But many of Lula's and Rousseff's policies remain popular. For their success in reducing poverty by 55%, extreme poverty by 65%, and an overall decrease in rampant inequality. Your reporter spoke with Maria Luisa Mendonça, director of the Network for Social Justice and Human Rights in Brazil, and professor at the University of Rio de Janeiro's International Relations Department. Here, Professor Mendonça explains why she believes that a right-wing coup is responsible for the impeachment of Dilma Rousseff and now the imprisonment of Lula da Silva, and what the future holds for progressive political forces in Brazil.
In 2016, there was a coup against President Dilma Rousseff. She was elected and then re-elected. And that was after Lula was elected and re-elected. So the Workers' Party had been in power for 4 consecutive elections in Brazil and implementing a progressive agenda in the country, social programs that were very popular. So the right-wing parties knew that they could not win elections. They could not take power through a democratic process. So they orchestrated a parliamentary coup against President Dilma Rousseff. And they used an excuse saying that, you know, she had committed some administrative crime. But the thing is, her administration was doing something very common that all the previous administrations had done, which was to delay payments from the federal budget to the public banks to pay for social programs such as low-income housing, for example. And most Brazilians don't even understand the reason for the impeachment, because people think that she was accused of corruption, but they had no case of corruption against her. So the main reason for the impeachment was for the right-wing powers to take over the government and to implement a conservative agenda to cut social programs, you know, to privatize public companies, to implement austerity measures in Brazil that were not popular. And then this year, former President Lula was leading the polls for the presidential elections that will happen in October, are supposed to happen. We don't know what's going to happen because there is such political instability in the country now. And they also orchestrated a case against him, saying that he received an apartment as a bribe, but there is no proof that he owns. He doesn't own the apartment. He never spent any time in the apartment. So all the case was based in one testimony of a company executive, a construction company executive that was in prison and had his sentence reduced from like 15 years to 2 years in exchange for accusing Lula. So, you know, now he's in prison and he's still very popular even after his arrest. If elections were today, he would win in all types of cases, of scenarios.
Lula is in prison. I've heard there is a protest encampment out in front of the prison building where he is now located. What is the future of the Workers' Party and other progressive popular movements such as MST, the Landless Workers Movement in Brazil, as they confront a system that has veered very much hard right over recent years?
Yes, the social movements in Brazil face a great deal of repression now. Just a few days ago, this camp in front of the prison was attacked by gunmen, and they shot at people when they were sleeping, and 2 people got wounded. So, yeah, that is a serious threat of repression. Almost all types of mobilizations, protests face now police violence. And we also had the case a little over a month ago of a congresswoman from Rio Marielle Franco, who was assassinated with four bullets in the head and killed. So, you know, in addition to dozens of leaders of social movements, peasant movements, the landless workers movements, who have been killed since last year. So we see a great deal of repression in the countryside and in urban areas, and also, you know, of social leaders, grassroots movements, and also any type of protest against the coup. Usually, you know, the response is police repression. After the impeachment of President Dilma Rousseff, we realized that we could not trust any institutions in the country. The Supreme Court is part of the coup. Mainstream media outlets support the coup. It's really difficult for people to mobilize. That's why having international visibility is important.
That was Maria Luisa Mendonça, director of the Network for Social Justice and Human Rights in Brazil, and a professor at the University of Rio de Janeiro's International Relations Department. Learn more about the current political crisis in Brazil by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on Carib Rhythms International Radio in Tucker, Georgia, WOZO in Knoxville, Tennessee, KSER in Everett, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Nikita. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
Murder Incorporated, Dreaming of Empire, Book 1, by Mumia Abu-Jamal and Stephen Vittoria. The colony he helped found, the colony he helped create, did not hesitate to execute Quakers or go medieval on those considered to be witches. Slavery was cool, too. And according to the Puritan ethic of the time, slavery was condoned in the professed holy book and not perceived as a slight against God. Just a few extra hands around the house, you know? Sure, Africans were already enslaved in the neighborhood when Winthrop showed up, but he clearly supported the practice as governor, writing the very first law on the American continent, sanctioning the enslavement of Africans. In fact, Winthrop enjoyed wheeling and dealing in the slave trade, especially after the Pequot War, 1634-1638, when the Massachusetts Bay Colony, led by Winthrop, enslaved many of the captured Pequot Indians. But the captured warriors, who weren't taking this shit lying down, were still freaking out the good church folk. So Winthrop traded these insurgents for cotton and tobacco and Negroes. Now the Winthrops, who wanted to keep up with the Joneses, also needed some help around the house, so they kept three Pequot slaves for themselves. American exceptionalism and Christendom at its absolute best, indeed a shining city on the hill. Vacuum domicilium, or no man's land. Anders Stevenson, professor of history at Columbia University, and the author of a remarkable discourse on the foundation of American empire entitled Manifest Destiny, American Expansion and the Empire of Right, makes a powerful case regarding the molten core of Europe's religious drive to conquer and colonize the Americas. For Europeans, land not occupied by recognized members of Christendom was theoretically land free to be taken. When practically possible, they did so. The Christian colonizers of the Americas, including the Spanish and the Portuguese, understood theirs as sacred enterprises. But only the New England Puritans conceived the territory itself as sacred. This, then, was the New Canaan, a land promised to be reconquered and reworked for the glory of God by his select forces, the saving remnant in the wilderness. Charged with the dominion of providence, the European settlers, read occupiers, engaged in a practice known as vacuum domicilium, also known by another Latin term, terra nullius, which is derived from Roman law and translates to land belonging to no one or no man's land. Initially, many of the first colonists attempted to acquire the title to the land they occupied, but quickly abandoned that practice, as it was considered an attempt to respect sovereignty and instead embrace the notion that law is politics by other means. Embarking on an all-out land grab via vacuum domicilium, if the property is not in active use, then it's simply free for the taking. So if the terrain was used seasonally by the indigenous population for farming, hunting, or fishing, and appears barren, too bad. The occupiers can simply claim the land. In fact, the colonizers made a straightforward, God-inspired rule. The rights of civilized Christians superseded the rights of the hunter-gatherers, heathens, and savages. The Protestant Reformation, Christianity's 16th century schism between the Roman Catholic Church and early Protestant reformers led by John Calvin and Martin Luther, laid the necessary foundation for biblical prophecy to be used as the spiritual motivation for the occupation of this new Israel, as well as the eventual removal of, as Jefferson and Franklin later defined them, savages. Stevenson suggests, the Book of Revelation, in short, made sense to English Protestants in general and Puritans in particular. It allowed the Reformation to be interpreted as either a moment on the way to Armageddon or even as the battle itself. Surely, it could not have been an accident either that God had unveiled this new world, this new continent, hidden for so many ages, precisely at the moment when the process of purification had begun in the old world. And this process of purification was happening everywhere in the Americas. Stevenson continues, every activity, personal and communal, was irreducibly part of the holy war against Satan and his infidels. The aristocracy of saints had to work ceaselessly at this critical moment to make the present world as solemnly and gloriously Christian as it could be. The Puritans, true to their name, placed tremendous weight on always defining who was inside and who was outside when it came to their communal existence. The message to the heathens outside was, in this respect, as radical as St. Paul's, see the light or perish in eternal damnation. In the Virginia colony at the time, John Rolfe, when he wasn't busy cultivating and exploring tobacco and then marrying Pocahontas, Christianizing her, and changing her name to Rebecca, fortified the English occupiers of Virginia as a peculiar people, marked and chosen by the finger of God. From John Winthrop through Benjamin Franklin, almost 200 years later, American exceptionalism went viral, providing the necessary pretext and justification to exterminate the indigenous population at will until every last uncivilized, bestial, non-literate, undomesticated, feral, vicious, and barbarous savage was roadkill. First, let's hear from Winthrop regarding a smallpox epidemic that had wiped out the area's Indian population in the 1630s, something Winthrop viewed as divine intervention. God hath consumed the natives with a miraculous plague. Next, from the city of brotherly love, we hear from Ben Franklin regarding how rum was being utilized by God Almighty to help soften up the savages for the big kill. The appointed means by which the design of Providence to extirpate those savages in order to make room for the cultivators of the earth. This escalating myth of being the chosen people, cultivators of a new promised land, a new Israel, became an integral premise in America's bloated self-interpretation. Samuel Langdon, colonial American clergyman and president of Harvard University from 1774 until 1780, was a typical cheerleader for American exceptionalism during the twilight years of the 18th century when he preached at Concord, New Hampshire. We cannot but acknowledge that God hath graciously patronized our cause and taken us under his special care as he did his ancient covenant people. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Can a competently composed work of fiction disrupt the culture of war? Does participation in the military inevitably lead to moral degradation? Why does the official story of 9/11 continue to dominate public discourse about the incident more than a decade after the story has been intelligently challenged? Is the 9/11 truth movement still relevant more than 15 years after those devastating attacks? On this week's edition of the Global Research News Hour, we feature two literary works countering mainstream narratives around warfare in the 21st century. We'll first hear from author Stan Goff about his first work of fiction, Smittengate. Later, we'll hear from author George Grundy about his book, Death of a Nation. On this week's program, two author interviews, Stan Goff's anti-war novel, George Grundy on 9/11 and the rise of fascism in America. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 27th, 2018. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. North Korea finds itself in a win-win situation. If sanctions are eased and peace talks are managed in the right manner, then the process of socio-economic rebirth, which Kim Jong-un considers a priority, can begin. Should the rhetoric of war prevail in Washington, then Washington would find itself at odds with its main ally, Seoul. It is likely that China could even justifiably renounce its sanctions against the DPRK, blaming the U.S. for not making any progress in the face of extraordinary offers by Kim Jong-un to renounce his nuclear weapons. Washington would come across as the uncooperative party, and this would free the relevant parties, including allies, from taking the United States into consideration. That comes from the article, The Kim Moon DMZ Summit. Sophisticated North Korean diplomacy rewards Kim Jong-un. by Federico Pieraccini, posted April 27th, originally appearing at Strategic Culture Foundation. On April 20th, North Korea made the dramatic announcement of several decisions that included suspending further nuclear and missile tests and that its nuclear test center would be discarded in order to ensure the transparency of the suspension of the nuclear test. A number of analysts, including a Washington Post column by Max Boot on Saturday, mistakenly dismissed the offer by claiming that the test site is probably unusable anyway. North Korea's Punggye-ri nuclear test site, where North Korea has conducted 6 acknowledged underground detonations, is still, as far as we can tell, fully operational. Following Pyongyang's 6th nuclear test in September 2017, one area of the site, the North Portal, located at Mount Mantap, where the last 5 underground nuclear tests had been conducted, was apparently abandoned. However, significant new tunneling was noted at the West Portal, another area of the site, up through early March 2018. That comes from the article, DPRK's Closing the Punggye-ri Nuclear Test Site, posted April 26th, originally appearing at 38 North. In the joint declaration, the two Koreas agreed to play their roles and take responsible actions for denuclearization of the peninsula and make every efforts to gain international support for it. Moon and Kim agreed to talk over peninsula issues and build trust through regular summits and hotline talks. Moon will also visit Pyongyang this autumn, they said. To relieve military tension and reduce the possibility of war, the South and the North decided to halt any hostile activities. From May 1st, they will stop propaganda broadcasting over the inter-Korean border and make the demilitarized zone a peace zone where there are no military weapons. That comes from the article, Korea's Agree to Call for Formal End to War This Year, by Kim Ron, posted April 27th, originally appearing at The Korea Times. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar.
John Wilson here. I'm speaking with an American anti-war activist and writer, Stan Goff. He had a long career in the U.S. Armed Forces from 1970 to 1996, and he's written numerous books about his experiences in the military and his opinions about many different aspects of war. His latest work, Smittengate, is actually a fictional story that delves into corruption, the sex trade within the military, and a specific character's family. Why did you decide to write this book?
I've been wanting to try fiction for a long time, but I'm kind of frightened of it. It's really intimidating because you have to think a lot harder than when you write nonfiction, and you have much, you feel like you have a much higher level of accountability. So I said I'd try it out, and then once I got it plotted out, I started sort of getting interested in my own characters and plugged away at it, you know, between doing other stuff, between writing a lot of nonfiction for the last, 3 years or so. I don't know. Yeah, I just wanted to have a story of some kind because, one of my go-to theses in my nonfiction work is that human beings are story creatures. We really don't understand the concept until it's in the context of a story so we can see how it fits into life, you know, the way that you live it. And that, you know, I just published in 2015 Borderline, which is like this incredibly lengthy tome on gender and militarism, but dealing with it sort of abstractly and through, you know, name-dropping a lot of social critics and all that is one thing. It's another thing for to give examples of how that stuff actually plays out with people that you can identify with as just the same kind of, you know, screwed up people that you hang around with every day, you know.
Yeah, it's quite different than the kind of academic style or you know, an abstract opinion, and it's really an interesting story. You have the main character Dale, and the kind of the stress he's dealing with, and you know, not want to be a part of the, the military, but kind of being thrown into one last position. So it's written very, like, there's a lot of detail, and obviously it seems like, you know, it could only be written by someone who had experiences like yourself. Can you go into how you use that in your writing this fictional story?
Well, I wanted to write a book. I wanted to write a story about one that military people or ex-military people could identify with, because one of the things that annoys me as a former military, and I'm not valorizing that status in any way, I'm just saying one of the things that annoys me is to see how wrong a lot of writers get it when they write about the military. You know, they sort of rely on a lot of old, silly media-generated archetypes and whatnot. And then you have these sort of tropes that reoccur again and again, even the trope about the crazy veteran, though in this case, the fragmentation of his personality has to do with something else, you know, altogether. But, I'm losing the thread here, but I wanted people to have, who knew something about the military, not to be annoyed or disrupted in reading it by running into something that was obviously wrong. And the devil's always in the details and that stuff. And I actually had to, because I've been out for a long time, I had to go back and call on a couple of more recent veterans to ask them about, you know, things. Changes in equipment, uniform, policy, regulations, yada, yada, yada. I've been out for, 22 years now, so, you know, a lot has changed. But, yeah, I was also kind of trying to be a little sly. I wanted to write a book that looked like a war novel, that people who read war novels would pick up and then maybe dislocate them a little bit once they actually read the story.
Right. Yeah. It wouldn't be what they would expected. The pro war, rah, rah kind of story that, or kind of the special forces hero, that you would probably normally see, I guess, like the Hollywood type of story. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And now I was never on a team like the team that's represented in there, but every one of those characters is similar in some way to people that I did know when I was in the military. And just for the record, there is nothing even remotely autobiographical about this. It's fiction, okay? But in terms of just the way the guys relate to each other on the teams and all that stuff, that's something I wanted to kind of capture, because it's kind of like a dysfunctional family, you know what I mean? It's not this strict unit that everybody, you know, salutes and shoots and follows orders like Robotrons and Jason Bourne type characters.
Right.
They're not. Yeah. They're a bunch of, it's more of a frat boy atmosphere than an atmosphere of some highly disciplined, you know, highly organized outfit. It doesn't mean that they aren't trained in certain particular skills and can't do certain things, but a lot of people get this idea that these guys are like superhuman or somewhere. They're so brainwashed that they don't think and talk like the rest of us. And they really do. We do think and talk like everyone else. We listen to the same music. We're exposed to the same popular culture. You know what I mean? We have the same sense of humor and irony. So it's not like we're some other animal altogether. It's certainly not the idealized archetype where everybody's in it because, look, the guys that go into special operations in particular, patriotism might be a secondary motivation to them, but their main motivation is they're violent thrill seekers. And their main motivation for that is to satisfy some conception of masculinity that they're trying to live into. And I say that from firsthand experience, but that was something that quest for masculinity was something that was universal in that world, in that little subset of the military.
And in the story, would you say that you have the element of there's the private contractor and sex trafficking going on that the you know that the group a lot of them participate in or kind of are interested in. So would you say that relates to the hyper masculinity of you know being able to just pay for sex from you know?
Oh sure, yeah, and I mean. Prostitution and the exploitation of prostituted women is something that exists on the periphery of every military activity and always has. In this case, we're talking about prostitution in a facility with underage girls that are being being shifted around by military contractors. I actually sort of cribbed that from a lot of stuff that they caught people doing in Bosnia back when all that was going on. They're mm-hmm. military contractors, and I forget which company. Now they've all changed their names, but, you know, it was one of them. They start out like Blackwater, and then they call themselves the Institute for Peace or some shit. You know what
right.
I mean?
Yeah.
So, yeah. But, yeah, prostitution exists on the periphery of every military activity, and in places where people can get away with it, underage prostitution is quite popular. In fact, the most popular destination for, you know, middle-class businessmen in the United States who are doing sex tourism is to go to places like Thailand where they can go have sex with 12-year-old girls and stuff and then come back and, you know, they're just respectable, you know, dads again when they get back. You know, and that's a man thing, not a military thing, but when you get in the military, you've got all the man things concentrated. Especially in special operations, where these units are exclusively or almost exclusively male. All the same problems, only amplified, because men around other men feed off that stuff. They pump each other up. They get into a kind of an escalation dynamic of who can be most probative of one's own masculinity. And you've seen that. You've seen that with mm-hmm. guys.
The main character you have, Dale, he's one who takes exception to that, and I guess, you know, you set that up with his family life and how close he is with his daughter. Do you think, you know, that would play a big role, you know, just him, maybe he wasn't like that before he had a family, or would you say it's just certain people, you know,
yeah.
you know, don't...
I don't want to be too much of a spoiler for yeah. the next one, because I'm going to sort of dive into a little bit more of his... of his background, but Dale was someone who was never should have gone into the military, and it was almost inevitable that he would. And like I say, I don't want to spoil the sequel.
Yeah.
But yeah, there are guys that go in and think they can still maintain their integrity, and that integrity somehow corresponds to. A duty ethic, you know what I mean, and that itself that in turn corresponds to a higher good, you know, that's carried out by the state. No, you know, it's just standard modern episteme. And there's guys that go in thinking they can live into that stuff, and there's guys that go in thinking they can live into that stuff when they get in these cagey units. But when you get in there, that's not the foundation of the culture. It's a culture of ruthlessness, and ruthlessness never corresponds to moral improvement. It always corresponds to moral degradation. Now, when Dale discovers the level of degradation he's fallen to, that's when his personality begins to fragment, and he begins to have some dissociative episodes and whatnot start coming out at inconvenient times.
Right.
Yeah.
The name of the book is Smitten Gate. Is there a specific meaning to that? To the title?
Yeah, it's a sort of a midrash on the Isaiah quote in the epigraph. It's a Smitten Gate refers to the gate. At the entry gate to the City of Chaos, which is a prediction of a fallen Jerusalem, and one where people have pulled back inside their houses to hide, you know. In fact, the original title of the book, before I changed it, was going to be City of Chaos. That's directly from the quote, but I wanted to be just a wee bit more subtle than that.
Speaking of chaos, there is a...
But it's also, you know, and the idea of a broken door or a broken portal sort of says something about what's going on with Dale. But what's also going on with the beginning of the loss of innocence on the part of D'Angelo, too. His daughter.
Right, yeah.
D'Angelo Dale is his daughter. And he has a very loving relationship with her, but one that is conflicted by the fact that he refuses to live with his wife, which is sort of explained in the book. The overview is that Dale is this guy who, when he's a young fella, he's out tramping around Latin America, meets somebody in Belize, fall in love, come back, and they have a child. Her child turns out to be a prodigy. And they really, 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 really want to sort of maximize her potential. And so they need, for a young guy that has nothing but an English degree and can't get a job, he finds out he can go in the army and his wife is a nurse and they can make enough money to pay for this child's education. But the place he has to go to pay for that education is the military. Then when he gets in there, it turns out that he's actually quite good at everything because he enjoys the challenge. He's very physical. And he sort of moves up. He just moves up because he's constantly seeking these new challenges, which is part of his character, which should be good, but it takes him to a very dark place. And then one of the turning points is in Somalia, where he is a participant in the Task Force Rangers debacle there. And then the real turning point comes when he's sent to perform an assassination in Honduras in support of the 2009 coup, and it turns out to be a former colleague of his. And then things start to go to pieces. Well, long story short, he gets sent away to sort of cool his heels at language school out in California. And then after a year when he's learned Farsi, he goes back and he's assigned to this team in Afghanistan. And as soon as he hits the ground, he's already losing his mind. And he's assigned to this team and assigned to this sort of high priority mission. At the same time that his team is involved in committing a crime. And I won't say any more than that because it'll sort of throw it. But, you know, at this point, it's like, what could go wrong?
The story does have a lot of, I guess there's a lot of graphic elements in the writing. Is there a reason you decided to include things like that, kind of like the violence and sex and things like that?
Yeah, because people, it's irresponsible, in my opinion, to treat sex like it exists apart from power. It's irresponsible, in my opinion, to sanitize war. And those are two of the themes that sort of thread in and out of one another. Sex is always implicated with power, and war is always an obscenity. But what do I mean when I say that, and how do those two things relate to one another? And you kind of begin to see it. Again, it all goes back to these phenomena sort of orbit around this notion, notion of escalating masculinity. But, it's graphic because I don't want to sanitize military life. You can turn on the television and see people sanitize military life. 7 days a week, 365 days a year. You can
find plenty of people who want to write about sex like it's, oh, just the greatest thing in the world, and oh, no problem, and sex is, you know, sex is fun and yada, yada, yada. But the fact is, real sex for most people in real life is imbricated with power, and that power is patriarchal. And I think it's irresponsible to write about sex that way, especially about, and it's kind of interesting that the book came out in the same year that the whole Me Too thing took off, because it's all of a sudden women are beginning to reassert that and say, you know, you guys want to talk about sex, but let's talk about how you employ your power as males in the realm of sex. And all of a sudden, sex doesn't become so innocent anymore. And by writing graphically about it, I'm trying to tell the truth.
Now you're already working on a sequel.
It's going to take a lot longer because.
Were you kind of on that track before you finished this book, or did you decide, because it's your first big kind of fiction, published. So now you're on board with doing that.
Yeah. When I started plotting out the first one, I couldn't satisfy myself to finish it, without, looking at where it was going to lead. And in a way, I always kind of had my mind on the sequel when I was writing the first one. Again, maybe I'm just being, too clever by half, but I want the first book to pique somebody's curiosity if they're about to read that kind of thing. But the real story is in the sequel. The big story is in the sequel. And by the time the sequel comes out, then really the first book is just an appendage to it. It's something someone might read after they read New Moons. It's called New Moons and Sabbaths, an Isaiah reference again. I want to stay consistent. Mm-hmm. But the person that I really want to put out there as a character that might reoccur in later novels is D'Angelo Dale. But I can't write the book about D'Angelo Dale without writing the book about Abner Dale, her father. Mm-hmm. Because what happens in the book, I don't want to give anything away, is so pivotal for the rest of her life.
So you're very busy in getting this next one. Yeah.
There's other people from the book that are going to come back. There's other characters. Farah, her mother, is going to come back. Mm-hmm. A couple members of Dale's old team will show up again in there. And even one of the journalists will show up in there again. So we're going to bring them back. But then we're going to relocate them in a fictional town called Washington, New York, somewhere within 45 minutes of Syracuse.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned some of the, a lot of the themes of the story, but is there any kind of other themes that you really wanted to kind of get across, or points that you wanted to get across besides telling the story, like having the interesting characters and developing and showing this perspective inside the military?
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I wanted to do was, like I say, the character development for Dale, I'm going to do more character development on Dale in the second book, maybe, than I did in the first book. And I did a lot of character development on D'Angelo in the first book, but that's going to go much further in the second book. And D'Angelo, his daughter, becomes the main character. But one of the things about D'Angelo's character, and this is something that a lot of people don't realize about military cultures, particularly in the Army, is probably the most racially integrated culture in the United States. I'm talking about people where people live cheek by jowl with one another, don't just share consumer spaces. I mean, live with one another, watch one another's back, work with each other every day, learn the same language, wear the same clothes, and marry one another across those boundaries that are firmer outside the military. So in a sense, the military, for all its negatives, also has a sort of interesting creolism about it. And so that's kind of what led me to pick Farah as his love interest in the first one, because she's
Garifuna from Belize. She's coming from a very Creole culture, going to another Creole culture. And one of the things that I kind of see going on that's not talked about very much in the United States, but particularly with millennials and younger people, is even at this point where race has become this huge visible issue again, with the polarization of American politics around this, you know, sort of chronic insecurity, at the same time, our culture is now, especially with younger people, is more Creolized, and I think that's a good thing. I think that's a good thing. There are a lot of different kinds of what you call cultural fusion, I guess, going on. And I think it's going to redefine us demographically in 20 or 30 years. I just wanted to come up with a character that sort of represented something about that. Someone that doesn't exactly fit in any of the cliques that are out there now, but that also is a very integral, self-confident character. And that's one thing I want. D'Angela is someone who is simultaneously doesn't belong but still retains her self-confidence. And I think it makes an interesting character, especially as she gets older and suffers more of the slings and arrows of fortune, because the sequel is going to be 8 years after the first book.
So thanks so much for doing this interview.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca.
Jonathan Wilson here, and I'm speaking with a very special guest we have. He's an English-Australian author, media professional, blogger, and a businessman. And he's also the subject of today's interview. We're going to talk about his most recent book. It's titled Death of a Nation, 9/11 and the Rise of Fascism in America. It's George W. Grundy. Thanks so much for coming on the program.
Pleasure.
Now, I guess first, this book, based on the title, you could almost imagine it being about a bunch of different things, which it is, but it does have one main focus. Could you kind of get into the focus of your book and kind of the timeline it covers?
Well, look, your question is correct in that the book is about a couple of different topics. It starts, the first half of the book is about the events of September the 11th, 2001, arguing that that particular event was falsely portrayed to us, and in fact was carried out by the United States government and military, an attack on their own country in order to carry out a series of geopolitical maneuvers, which they did. But the second half of the book focuses on the effect of September the 11th, the effect of that devastating event on American political society, which I would argue has pushed America's center of politics so far to the right now that the word fascism isn't necessarily an overstatement anymore.
And so how did you, undertake this giant, compilation of information? Like, the book is just over 500 pages, and especially getting into all these details of the 9/11 attacks. Now, I'm someone who, spent a lot of time reading about all this kind of information, and I feel like you didn't miss much, that you could include, right? There's so much there. So how did you undertake this?
Look, you're right. It was a pretty big undertaking. The book itself took me just over 3 years to write, and there's an enormous amount of information in there. So yeah, it's a very, very long book, filled with a large amount of information. But perhaps I should explain how the process of questioning that event came about, because I'm not a conspiracy theorist. I'm not necessarily one of those people who believes that the lizard people run the world, and Diana was killed by the British government. Now, there's lots and lots of conspiracy theories out there. I'm not necessarily a conspiracy theorist at all. My curiosity in this event came about several years after 9/11, when I saw some footage of the seventh tower of the World Trade Center collapsing, and that seemed to me a peculiar event. Most people are actually unaware that the third tower collapsed at all in New York on 9/11, even to this day. And I just looked into that very casually and curiously, just to see if I could find an explanation as to why a 50-story building would have fallen down 7 hours after the attacks. And I couldn't find one. And the more I looked into that particular aspect of the story, the more I just found it concerning, the more I found that I couldn't resolve these things in my mind. So over a period of years, I started to put together information on that event, on that particular aspect of the event, but also all the other things that happened on 9/11. And what I found was, from my perspective, that not only was the Tower 7 collapse inexplicable, but there were lots and lots and lots of other things that happened on September the 11th that defy logic, that defy explanation, that defy the laws of physics. In the end, the other thing that I found amazing about it is it's all surprisingly obvious. It's all been a lot of the information that I found and collated came from very reputable sources. I was published in the New York Times. And I find that pretty interesting in itself, that there is so much information that contradicts the official story. And yet the official story has held up remarkably well in terms of public belief over the last 17 years.
That's true. It's 2018 now, and most people kind of scoff at a lot of the questions people still have about the events on September 11th, 2001. And another thing, your book, you really delve into the connections of those in power at the time with those who are blamed for the attacks. So you have the Osama bin Laden family and the Bush family, in businesses together, having this history. And these are all things that, those are interesting facts that have come out that people are go, wow, that's a weird coincidence. Or, oh, that's interesting. But in your book, when you just see it kind of, chapter after chapter, and you're like, not only the events of that day, but then the background, and then the people who are supposedly behind it, and then you have the connections with the Saudi Arabian government and how close they are. It matches the tone of your book, which I found your tone is like you're talking about how absurd this is.
Well, at the very least, I mean, no matter what you believe, you have to admit it's an absolutely unbelievable coincidence that the connections between the Bush family and the Bin Laden family are so extensive that the two protagonists, the two main protagonists in this story, happen to be connected so extensively. I mean, it's mind-boggling, whether you're a believer in the official story or otherwise, that as the attacks commence, the president's father is having breakfast with Osama bin Laden's brother. I mean, that's at the very least a mind-boggling aspect of the story. But there's so much more across the various protagonists, particularly the Bush family and their connections with the Saudis, that makes it begins to strain credulity when you look at how they treated the Saudis that were all trapped in the United States after the attacks, and the way that they managed to basically shepherd bin Laden family figures out of the country in a period when no commercial flights were allowed to take to the air. That seems strange. What I found was overall that you can put together a series of arguments about the events on the day, but surrounding that, there are so many other questionable events, happening things that put them together and you think to yourself, well, that seems strange. And then you come across another one and you go, well, that's amazing. But then you put 200 of them in a row and you go, well, I just can't support the weight of this bizarre coincidence here, there, and everywhere, and still hold faith in the official story.
And I agree. You know, at this time, it's so late to kind of have, you know, hope that this event is going to be exposed or fully drawn out, or the people involved would be prosecuted at this point. What are you kind of, you know, this book kind of paints a dark picture where this is just on the road towards a more dark future for the United States, especially with Trump in power. Is that a fair assessment of what you're thinking this is leading to?
I guess so. I mean, look, many of the main protagonists from the United States these days are now very, very old men. I point the finger at people like Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney. I'm not in favor of exonerating old people just because they're old. But 17 years has passed, and the story remains sacrosanct. And I think, to me, at this stage, I feel very comfortable in my assertion that 9/11 was overall a falsely characterized event. So I think what's interesting these days, I find it continually fascinating, is how to voice this opinion remains completely beyond the pale. And although the numbers that they, when they occasionally do surveys of Americans and other nations, asking them about their belief in how the events of September the 11th worked, they often find that a surprisingly large number of people are able to countenance the notion that on one level or another, the Bush administration either participated in or was aware of the attacks coming prior to their arrival. Those numbers are pretty solid even now. But in the mainstream media, to voice this sort of opinion is to just put your head on the chopping block, to assume that you're going to get shouted down as a lunatic, as someone who's completely out of their mind, beyond the pale. But on a broader scale, the thing that I find interesting is that without an exposure, without this event being re-examined, it invites a future one. It seems to me that it was broadly successful from the protagonist's point of view. They managed to carry out an attack, get away with it, not have that fairly obvious lie exposed, continue to hold political power, in fact have more political power, which they exploited because of the devastation of 9/11, and then carry out most of the things that they said they wanted to carry out in pre-published documents, which came out a year before 9/11. That seems like a successful venture, if you ask me.
Right, and you're talking about specifically the Project for a New American Century document, you know, talking about the ongoing wars that were going on now, the hope for that and the need for an event to trigger the public acceptance of that, which happened, and those people were in power at the time. What would you say, you know, you mentioned before your point about mainstream acceptance is kind of out of the question at this point. It seemed like there was a time maybe 10 years ago where the questions were being brought forward. But now, for instance, I'll notice anyone, even in Canada, say someone running for politics, if there's something on their Twitter account that they question something about 9/11, that would be them being kicked out of the party immediately. Is it that way in Australia?
Oh, look, down here in Australia, we're more focused on Australian things most of the time. But yeah, look, certainly there's nothing in the mainstream media that ever makes it there, which has a sensible person questioning that event in a sensible, methodical way, where they aren't just dismissed as a lunatic, as a the conspiracy theorist is a tag which people put on people who voice these sort of things, and it's sort of code for get crazed lunatic, and it's a really good way of putting people down. So no, I think there is no way at the moment of voicing concerns like this within within a mainstream media platform without just being subject to vilification and being, just being characterized as a deranged idiot.
Mm-hmm. So have you kind of felt any of that kind of treatment after publishing this book? I mean, I guess you've been writing about this for a while, obviously doing all this research. So, you know, are people, maybe people you know in just general relationships, not work relationships, do they tread lightly around these subjects around you?
No, absolutely not. And that's the interesting thing is that I've obviously sold some copies of the book around the world, and I've received emails and reviews from people all over the place, mostly supportive. The reviews I get tend to get 5 stars or 1 star,
right?
Which is fine with me. Mm-hmm. But personally, across the board, I'm a pretty regular kind of guy. I'm not living a vastly alternative lifestyle, so I meet a lot of people who are white collar businessmen, normal. Mainstream center-ish people, and I've told them that I've written this book, given them copies. Lots of my friends and associates, and people I work with, have read the book, read the contents, and it's amazing how very few of them have come back and said, "No, I think this is complete rubbish," and I don't think they're just being nice to me. I think it's amazing how across the board, and not just in my social circle, but across the board. People are very open to the idea. People are very open to the concept of examining the idea that potentially there is something more to this story than we were told. And potentially even the easiest way in is to discuss the idea that potentially the Bush administration was so negligent in the months and year coming up to that event that it almost amounts to complicity. And then from there, people can get themselves across the board to the point where they think to themselves, well, look, I'm willing to accept the notion that the Bush administration purposely ignored warnings in order to allow this thing to happen. But it is a leap of faith, and I think that's one of the reasons why, in some ways, the story was so successfully held up, is to reach the point where I have, for example, really makes you re-examine virtually everything you assume about society, because it's such a big event. I mean, it's the largest event in most of our lives, the largest current affairs event. And in order to re-examine it completely and come to the conclusion that I have, which I still find disturbing, really forces you to re-examine virtually everything you assume about society. And that's, I think, one of the barriers to entry, if you will, to people coming to the conclusions that I have, because you have to just change everything you think.
I also want to ask you about, I guess, the difference between getting this information out to people now, like 2018, whereas maybe when the ability to get this kind of information in 2005 or 6. So now with so much social media and kind of the explosion of all these different facets of the internet, it might seem like it's easier, but I almost feel like there's too much and too many people who can post their own YouTube videos of edits of questioning things, where how does someone start somewhere, you know, if they're questioning 9/11?
Like I said before, I mean, I found that the information on the event of 9/11 was surprisingly mainstream, surprisingly obvious, and surprisingly easy to get. I agree that we live in a world that's so stratified these days that it's a slightly different paradigm to the one we had back in 2018. But I still think that the information is there. It's fairly easy to understand. But on a broader scale, the problem I think we face as a society these days is that people live in little silos of information. People get their information via things like Facebook. That means that you generally find that a lot of people get their information from people who already agree with them, people who are already feeding them that which they already know, that don't feed them challenging notions. And that is a concern, I think, not just for American society, but for all society, because eventually what it leads to is people being misinformed. And that was, I think, fairly spectacularly shown during the 2016 American election.
Yeah, it's definitely threw a lot of people for a loop. But I guess, you know, when people live in their own world, they're not exposed to the other extreme views out there, right? Is that fair to say that that I guess people need to broaden their horizons and the way our information society is constructed, it's kind of against that because it wants us to click on the things we like.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, what would you say your thoughts are on because this event, you know, the 9/11 attacks and people questioning it kind of spurred a, you know, a movement to activism, people trying to get information out, especially, you know, difficult thing to do early on. And now there's a lot of ways to get information out, but what are your thoughts on kind of what the 9/11 truth movement has accomplished or failed to accomplish in kind of exposing this?
That's a good question. I'm not really a part of the 9/11 truth movement in that I'm not a member of any particular group. I think that over the years, the 9/11 truth movement has, for the most part, been pretty helpful. It is, it's been filled with a lot of people who are reputable and intelligent and have asked legitimate questions. And just like in most other groups, there are some kooks. There are some people out there who claim that there were no planes that hit the buildings or that there were holograms or things like that.
Right.
And that's for people trying to seek, inverted commas, the truth, that can be unhelpful because, you know, there are some lunatics out there who are, you know, going on about lizards and, yeah, no planes and that sort of thing, and that's just not a particularly helpful point of view. But overall, look, over the years, the 9/11 truth movement has brought out some very, very smart people who've put together some very, very smart and intelligent papers and books, which have been reasonably widely disseminated. And I think overall, there is a broad consciousness, certainly in the American public. You see this from anecdotal and survey evidence that there are some significant questions about 9/11. And even if you're not willing to cross that particular Rubicon and become someone who holds an entire question mark over the event, I think there is a broad consciousness that there are some aspects to that day's events which are extremely questionable.
Mm-hmm. And there's still, it's not like information won't still come out. And specifically, you know, recently there was the declassified paper talking about the connections to Saudi Arabia and funding some of those the suspected of carrying out the attack and things like that. The mainstream it seemed to kind of cover it, but you know, gloss over it like this case is still closed. But yet, like you say, the information's readily available to those who want it. Do you expect any other kind of maybe not bombshells, but more kind of important information to still come out?
That's a good question. It's, I think there is somewhere in this world some bombshell evidence, I think. For example, to take one example, the Pentagon building, which was covered in CCTV cameras, none of that footage has ever been released except for five frames, which didn't show a plane. And there was various other Sheraton Hotel and various other businesses nearby who had CCTV cameras that would have captured that the last moments of the alleged flight. I think that footage may be somewhere sitting in a drawer, and if that came out, that could provide bombshell evidence. Whether it will, I doubt. But over time, these things, you know, unfortunately, we the public are deemed privy to these things in a very slow, deliberative process. I mean, my understanding is that there's a series more, the JFK papers that are due to come out, I think, next month. Mm-hmm. That's 55 years after the event. So, that these things may dribble out in the end, but by then it will be too late. And that's what concerns me is that anyone questioning whether this is something we should focus on, given it was nearly 17 years ago, just turn on the radio, just turn on the TV, watch for an hour, watch Fox for an hour, see how long you wait before you hear the term 9/11, because the power of the event is still very much there in the public consciousness. It's used all the time. Whenever there's any reference to America's national security, to terrorism, to the need for the wars, for the need for the military budget, count the seconds until you hear someone just say 9/11. Because of 9/11, we need to do this. Because of 9/11, this justifies some other thing. And that to me is the key aspect of the story today, because it's a story that happened 17 years ago. You could easily say it was a terrible day. There were some terrible people. Even if they did it, well, look, they're old men now. It's gone, but it isn't gone. If you turn on the media, it's there all the time. It justifies everything that goes on in America and all their spending. And behind it is the threat of another attack. Behind it is the fear, and I think it should be most people's greatest fear, is what happens in the United States if there is another major terrorist attack under a man like Donald Trump. Because I don't think you need to be a conspiracy theorist or even a liberal to be concerned that a man with authoritarian tendencies like Trump and the power of the state now behind him in many ways exaggerated and concentrated because of 9/11. In the event of an attack, Trump will ruthlessly exploit that for his own political gain. I think it would be something that he would view as, I was almost going to say, desirable. And that's to me the crux of the story today, is that power of that event 17 years ago is still very much there.
All right, that's great. So, thank you so much for doing this interview, George W. Grundy. The book is Death of a Nation, 9/11 and the Rise of Fascism in America. Thanks so much for doing this interview.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you, Jonathan.
This is Michael Welch, the Global Research News Hour. Thanks for those interviews, John.
Oh, yeah, my pleasure.
First of all, with Stan Goff's Smittengate, I was wondering what your reaction was to the way this, as a work of fiction, might help to undermine the narratives around war.
It definitely gives a different perspective. You have a bunch of kind of frat boys thrown together in this foreign land, and it's just kind of. The characters you see how being put in this kind of moral ambiguity, they often kind of will go for the lowest common denominator, whereas there's the sex trafficking involved in the book and how prevalent that is and commonplace, kind of accepted among people involved in war-torn areas who are kind of, in a all-male environment. So it kind of touched on a lot of those aspects that you don't ever really see much of in kind of war military-based fiction.
George Grundy's book, as relevant as it might be to question the official story of 9/11, it doesn't seem to be as necessary as debunking a lot of the narratives around Russiagate and Russian interference with the elections. I just wanted to know if you have any thoughts about if you are in full agreement with Mr. Grundy about that relevance, or maybe there's a caveat there.
I would say, they're related in some ways, but they're completely different. Election fraud and kind of the idea of democracy is completely, it seems like a frail thing at this point. We're like, oh, everyone voted for this guy. But then you also look back and you're like, well, does it even matter if everyone, the people you vote in are involved in this kind of terrorism, you know, false flag terrorism or these kind of these kind of deceptions, the possibility of behind the scenes can make things really confusing. But at the same time, you go back to 9/11, you're like, well, we've never recovered from that.
You pointed out social media, and yet we've got what we call fake news, which includes a lot of mainstream media stuff. And that might be a, like, you know, I think you suggested in the interview, a critical distinction from that, just the early years around 9/11.
Yeah. And it, the independent media, you could kind of, it was easier to critically analyze and be like, oh, okay, these people are legit independent media or, you know, but who knows, you know, who's funding what independent, in quotations, media these days. And there's so much of it. So everyone can be kind of living in whatever reality they choose. But it's great that these books like Grundy's book, when you put things in a book and get it published, it kind of it allows you to kind of critically look things over, you know, all in one place, and kind of make decisions based on that.
Okay. Well, John Wilson, thank you very much.